Okay, so it's a little after one. For the afternoon, the next couple hours, we're going to have some discussion and then finish off the day, I believe, at 3 o'clock on picking a few of the measures to take a look at for the purposes of understanding the process, learning the N2F methodology as a basis for us then to look forward to how do we extend that beyond clinical measures into perhaps behavioral and community health measures. And there will be some of the methodologists calling in, I believe, on the phone to help us with that. And I believe we'll start with immunizations, which might be an easy way. Is that true?
Yes.
An easy way to really look at not only the clinical, but think about behavioral and population health, since there are certain states where nearly all the vaccinations in the state are given by the state health department down south. So they might wonder what the clinical role is for that matter. So, first of all, some housekeeping. Rita, did you want to talk about dinner for tonight? Oh, okay.
We just wanted to remind everyone, if you're interested in having dinner with your colleagues tonight, our colleague Sheila Crawford is outside, and she will make arrangements, so just make sure you stop by and see her.
Okay. So an important question, I think, for this next section, discussing population health measures, is what is the outcome we're seeking? What is the product we need to develop when we're all finished? So we thought we'd ask Helen to speak about that a little bit so we can keep the end in mind.
Great, thanks. So our end goal here, obviously, is to think about bringing in what you would view as high-priority population health measures that we can bring in for endorsement in the second phase of this project. So part of our goal today has been, for example, to have at least a little bit of an initial review of our evaluation criteria and think about how those fit. The discussion we had earlier about our definitions, perhaps, of population health. And I think the issue for us now is, as we kind of face this next set of questions, is if our end goal is to get to a set of endorsed population health measures in some prioritized areas like obesity, smoking, and physical activity, we need to write that call for measures, essentially. What are we going to ask the broader measurement community to respond to? What are we going to ask them to submit? And once it gets to us, how are we going to evaluate it? Which I'll return to the discussion we had this morning. Ask people had a chance to, I think, reflect on some of our reviews of the measures this afternoon. But we want to be able to call for a set of measures, and we need to be able to be crisp and explain what we mean. We've already done some of this work, and it might be helpful. It hasn't been done in a way that has allowed us the luxury of having this very thoughtful foundational work first. But, for example, Riva just led our child health quality project where we all endorse numerous measures at the state level, for example. There's a low birth weight measure, for example, that is a state level of analysis. There are multiple measures that came out of the National Children's Health Survey that got at issues like missed days of school and some of the more classic population health measures that currently have only been able to be analyzed to the state or community level. So we've already done this. We've brought in the ARC. Many of the ARC prevention quality indicators, for example, the preventable hospitalization measures that are supposed to reflect community capacity for primary care. So we've gone down this path a bit, and I think what we'd like to do with this is be a bit more purposeful as we go into this next phase of work and help you have us write that call in a way that brings in the measures you're going to want to see put out there. So
one thing that I heard you say is that the scope really, or that is around tobacco use towards tobacco, obesity, and physical activity. So is that, in fact, where HHS is funding N2F or where N2F intends to have these population measures focused around?
We have had discussions with HHS about what they thought were the prioritized areas, and those seem to rise to the top. That's not set in stone, per se. There's obviously something we've left off that you think would be really important. I think the concern was this is such a different area. We should do this in a way that we have confidence that this is the right foray. We'll be learning from it. Might we do something different the next time we call for measures? And I think this isn't our first and only, attempt at looking at health measures. I think this will be hopefully the focus of all of our projects going forward. And I think ultimately what we hope is sort of like the way last, 2 years ago we did a framework for how to evaluate composite measures and brought in composite measures to that project. Now all of our measures bring in composite and individual level measures. I think in the same way we're starting to think about in 2 years when the cardiovascular measures are up again, how would the call for measures look different? What kinds of measures will we bring in that won't have that more narrow clinical view you'll see today, but how do we get that broader expanse? So it's not just a one-time project. The thought was, should we pick a few areas for this project, get our feet wet, see how it goes, and then really move on to standardizing this into every project we do.
Just a clarification. Were the words tobacco, obesity, and physical activity, or tobacco, nutrition, and physical activity? I'm just curious.
It was not that precise. I think it literally just said smoking, physical activity, and obesity. But again, I think there's a lot of degrees in there. We just thought it'd be helpful to have three areas. Whether those are the right three, we know the other advantage of those three areas is we are trying to get somewhat at that Venn diagram. Those are also areas where there are clinical measures. So we thought it'd be interesting to have the opportunity to have a project where we could actually try to harmonize some of those concepts as well.
Okay. So there's no plan to just go through the existing clinical measures and add or look at it from a population health component as opposed to calling for all brand new measures? That's the first question.
We will, as part of our expectation is, at least in those three areas, we will look at the clinical measures in those areas when we're looking at the population health measures. We already have measures in some of those areas, both new and existing. So, for example, Joint Commission just did a whole new series of smoking measures for hospitals. It'd be logical that we look at those in the broader context of whatever comes in the second phase of work. So it won't be that there's an expectation that the population health measures just have to be an aggregation of the clinical measures, but we also want to have that opportunity, and this came up this morning, to make sure that one set of measures is not put at a disadvantage, or, you know, that one has to lead the other necessarily.
And then the second component is, you said that the cardio measures aren't open again for another 2 years, and one in three, so heart disease and stroke, biggest killers. 2 years seems like a long time to apply population measures or population aspects of a measure if indeed that's one in three on killing U.S. citizens. And so I wonder if there's an opportunity even to relook at that to say, hey, we just got done redoing cardio, but 2 years is way too long if what work we do in here is really going to have an impact, and cardio being a great place to do that.
All those things are certainly open. We just have our usual schedule when we know we're going to look at all the measures, and that's a certainty. If there's other opportunities, we'll try to meet them. I think that was also the logic of the ones we showed. They're obviously a huge impact on cardiovascular disease as well.
I suspect if we run out of population measures of cardio disease, we have to start now anyway to catch back up in 2 years. So.
This is a refrain that will probably begin to get annoying to other committee members, but it's about, again, the distinction between determinants and outcomes. Smoking, nutrition, and exercise are not measures of health. They're measures of determinants of health. And I'm just curious if the charge to this group is about coming up with measures of health. It's an important question because I think if we start with measures of health or health outcomes, that is, in my mind, the appropriate way to frame the work to go back to those things that have the biggest influence on health. But starting with the things that we think are the determinants leaves a gap, at least in the sort of the model that we're trying to use.
I mean, I think I want to build on that point. Because as I said, I think if we're thinking about where we want to get and how to measure where we want to get so the outcomes are right, from my perspective, as I've worked in community health prevention and equity work, we end up with community determinants. And one of the things we've discovered is often a good solution solves multiple problems. And so, for example, if we talk about an issue like walkability, you know, we're talking about health, you know, we're talking about physical activity, we're talking about safety at the same time. I mean, in terms of lives, clearly we're talking about chronic disease. In terms of years of potential life loss, and some of the broader equity issues. I think we have to talk about chronic diseases, and I would include the asthma at times because I think there's enormous opportunity there, and we also have to talk about injury. So I guess I'm questioning a little bit the assumption, and I definitely wouldn't talk about obesity, I talk about healthy eating, but I'm questioning the, not necessarily that it's the best place to start, but that there could be better thought about whether the best place to start is automatically healthy eating, active living, or even physical activity and tobacco, or whether there are a couple of other things that are just as compelling. But from my mind, a broader definition, if we're going to talk about population health, that doesn't say that that's the determinant, but really looks more broadly at what, you know, what the underlying determinant, you know, healthy food in stores, for example, takes in healthy eating and tobacco at the same time.
You're actually trying to respond to these criteria, because these criteria are actually saying those kinds of things. Do measures kill more birds with one stone? That's kind of what this is. In a more equitable, proactive way.
I just have a question for Helen that's a kind of a follow-up to Matt and Larry's question. In your talking with HHS, because there is some overlap in the framing between sort of the obesity and physical activity frames, do you have the opportunity to go back to them and say, you know, we decided we were going to choose two of those three or lump those in some way, and because those have the advantage that they have clinical measures, but we might choose one that really is more something that would be a health outcome that would be different that way, and that maybe might not have any corresponding clinical measures, and just see what we learn from that to maximize our learning. Is that something that's possible?
It's certainly possible. Yeah, I think it would also be helpful for me to actually have Matt or somebody, I think, Richard, again, we're all talking about the same thing. It would be helpful to actually try to distinguish what are determinants versus your health outcome. I think actually a few examples of that. I'm not sure we're all thinking of it in the same way.
Yeah, because when you said determinants, I thought of social determinants, yeah. Not proximal measures or outcomes. So there's another language.
We talked about the notion of this causal pathway between determinants and outcomes. And you can think of the social, environmental, genetic factors leading to behavioral factors which lead to physiological determinants which lead to disease factors which lead to functional status which lead to quality of life. In an intricate sort of causal pathway that has feedback loops and the rest, but I think just important distinctions between those things at the right-hand side of that that have to do with life expectancy and quality of life and the distribution of health in the community versus those things that affect or determine those outcomes.
I have my support as well.
Yeah, so I think that the causal pathway is the way to think about this, but I'm not unhappy with these obesity and activity and nutrition because they are, in a way, the result of the different kind of activities that different healthcare sector or other sectors, public health, do. So I think if you want to make a distinction between the activities that different parts of the health system do and the results that come from that, it's okay. And these are three things that people care a lot about, even though they may not be the ultimate goals. They gather attention. We can then think, you know, how can the different entities within the broader health system make a difference in those?
Is anybody else an informaticist on the panel? Because I'm just thinking of an informatics solution that might help us. So informatics is involved with knowledge management. So basically what we're talking about is concepts that have parents and children, right? So some of these, so when we talk about some of these bigger ideas, the idea that something could be the parent of a number of different children health conditions. So like you're saying, the walkable environment
actually children of that outcome measures of that would affect cardiac, obesity, work life, you know, so it would be a variety of things all going up to one sort of in a hierarchy of conceptual framework. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
Because there's such an overlap involved. Some of these measures, they would all sort of stem up to the same idea.
I think we can see who our audience is, that both NQF and many of the components of HHS are very clinically oriented. So if we can frame something in terms of, you know, major underlying causes of death, tobacco, if you want to call it obesity or nutrition and exercise, I think they'll get that. If we lead with walkability, they'll say, where does this come from? I mean, I still think if we talk about these three things, walkability is going to be a clear measure with many cascading benefits to it, but at least it's in a context that will be received.
I agree with you. I do think, though, there's a question about short-term change versus making statements that promote the kind of change we really need to see in this country. And I'm fearful of continuing to go with the status quo at a time when our health care is really, really struggling and we have virtually no prevention, and continuing to affirm the old way of thinking.
So the first question for this afternoon is what is a population health measure? And I think that we're getting into that. So one way of answering that question might be, a population health measure is one that's set in a context of a causal pathway that will connect the actions of different entities, including healthcare providers and others, to population health outcomes that we're concerned about. So some of the things that we do, like a prevention measure we'll be talking about later, if seen in that context, could be seen as population health measures. It's just a way of framing the issues, maybe.
Will we have at some point and I don't know whether the LA document is going to do this, we all have different ways of wanting or thinking about framing what the group is going to do and how it will approach its work. And because we're all coming from different points of view and frames, even when we're talking, as you said before, using the same language, we're still talking about different stuff, different things. We're understanding it differently. Is there any way to, between now and some next meeting, to lay out the alternative ways in which this might be approached so that we could reach consensus on the approach that we're taking here, rather than starting down a path without having had the opportunity to decide that that's really the path that we want to move down? I'm thinking, so that's the first thing. And then I'm thinking about the HHS consensus statement on quality in the public health system, and asking myself, how does that apply? Is that the set of metrics that we should be using to determine whether any measure, in addition to the frame that NPF usually uses, which elements what you were describing earlier, is that another lens through which we should be looking at any measure that we pick, that it fits in one or more of those categories, because HHS has already consensed around those being the aims for the public health system? If they have, then there's already consensus, and so we ought to be using it and promoting it.
Well, the core would be to the clinical measures, look at the five attributes, the safe, effective, patient-centered, fair enough. And I don't know that it does, but specifically, do they? So,
everything will cross to essentially the National Quality Strategy or previously the aims of the IOM. So yeah, we do specifically look at measures in each of those buckets, yeah.
I'm a little sorry, Madeline. Go ahead.
I like those three areas for a lot of different reasons, because of course they address major issues of mortality, but I think there is a lot of overlap with previous work that's been done, and I would agree that we are not as well established as we would like to think we are in the area, and Dr. Neely is not here, but in smoking and performance evaluation for smoking cessation where we need to be, certainly. And in the area of exercise, there's a tremendous amount of work which has appeared in the research literature, which is not getting translated at all into performance evaluation standards. I really think there's some important work that we need to do there. Being new to the process, I'm still struggling about where we look at outcomes versus determinants. And I liked what Michael said about does it really matter as long as we set it in that causal pathway.
So the other way to look at what we're doing is, in a sense, it's a proof of concept. And INTRA hasn't done this before. So the smoking, I'll say obesity and exercise, instead of nutrition and activity. But those are things that are clearly understood. They are the major underlying causes of death and disability in this country. And they're also, in fact, was a pretty clear example of how alignment of the public health and clinical sector actually did something important. So it's a really good one to pick as a proof of concept. So, you know, and the same, I think, with physical activity and nutrition, clearly there can't be a greater need in this country. We haven't yet gotten to the same place where the case is as clear as it is in tobacco about aligning public health and clinical medicine, although there's a lot of good work going on there now, so that's a little bit more of a stretch. And so those three things may be a very good proof of concept, so that NQF and AJS comes back and says, yeah, this makes sense, let's broaden how, you know, the areas in which we do this. Matt and then Linda. Larry, is that just a standing? Oh, okay. I'm calling you every third person, okay?
It's just a small point, but just in our conversation, people speaking in support of smoking and nutrition and exercise argue that those are good measures because they're major contributors to death and disability. So that mental model suggests that death and disability are the population health outcome measures that we care about, and that smoking, nutrition, and exercise are along the causal pathway determinants of those outcomes. And so, you know, perhaps, I agree they're important measures, but I think we at least need to have the discipline of saying, this is our framework. These are the population health outcomes, and they're even in people's language in this conversation, it's death and disability. So the question I still have is, where are death and disability or functional status in this framework? And how do we make that linkage in the causal pathway without just jumping into smoking and nutrition?
Do you have a suggested answer to that question?
That we have outcome measures as well as these measures, and if what we're saying underlying why we believe smoking is important is because we believe death is important, then death may be a measure of mortality or mortality amenable to things we can fix is a population health outcome measure that we start with, and then we say we're going to focus on smoking because smoking is the biggest improvable contributor to that.
Ron, I don't know if you recall, but the United Health rankings, and this may not be your area, but there is a measure that is used for years of preventable life loss or something like that, and it's actually looked at among different populations, African American, Caucasian American. So is that the type of thing you're talking about?
It's a measure of mortality, yes. Yeah. It's years of potential life loss, I think. Yeah. Yeah. You start,
The LA discussion this morning, I think Matt talked about health status indicators and then having performance measures that are more on the causal factors of contributing to that indicator. And then so, yeah, I do think we've got some terminology issues here.
I believe Linda was next.
I'm not sure where this point fits into this discussion, but I was just going to make the point that, I think an advantage of looking at physical activity and nutrition is that those are areas for which there's really less clarity about the role of clinical systems, and they're probably much more addressable at a community or population level. And so I think those two particularly really do stretch things more into that side of the picture, because while there are clinical ways of addressing them, they're probably less effective overall than non-clinical ways of addressing those issues. So I think it really does help to move things into that direction.
And I think it's bariatric surgery centers per 1,000 population as a measure.
We mentioned it earlier this morning, the work that RWJ has done with the county health rankings, and you mentioned it briefly, and they have that, policy as the base and sort of a cyclical policy, health risk factors that include the social determinant. So what he's talking about as a determinant are actually risks to the outcome, which is mortality, quality of life, and years of potential life loss. Or, I think they actually use quality life years lost, which is different.
So can I just bring this back to what we practically will have as our outcome? So say we decide on this framework and we call for measures. Who would be submitting measures and what would that mean? So, in other words, would we come up with our framework, call for measures, and then Kaiser Permanente would come and say, we want to rate ourselves on one of these measures? Is what we are saying practical for the people who are invested in getting measures from NQF? So how would a Kaiser Permanente use a population-level measure?
I think it could be used at a lot of levels. I'll let that answer that, but I think it could also be used at the community level. I think that's the point, is we're trying to get out of the box of it only being...
I'd just like to see, have it explained so that we could make the links. That'll help our thinking.
Well, we could, but I think it goes back to the important conversation we had earlier when I was talking about the evolution of the triple aim, IHS triple aim, is that single entities join Triple Aim Collaborative and quickly realized that single entities couldn't achieve the triple aims. If we're talking about population health outcomes, Kaiser Permanente can't do it alone and needs to participate in a broader multi-stakeholder collaboration with schools and employers and public health and social services and the rest to achieve these outcomes. So
you would select the measure and then get some measurement with your partners?
Yes.
And then you would say, we have reached this level of measured population level performance with our partners.
And that we could measure our contribution to the determinants as performance measures for our organization. So, I think it's in that causal pathway where the healthcare organization can contribute would be a performance measure as well. That's a determinant performance measure as opposed to an outcome.
So the community putting prevention to work, which is part of the American Recovery Investment Act, did fund around 50 communities to look at tobacco and obesity, and that did require a large consortium being put together. There was no, as you said, there's no single entity can deal with those issues at the community random level. So there is some experience. The evaluation of that is ongoing, although I heard the evaluation may not obviously turn out to be quite what's expected. Hard to prove these things. Mike?
Two quick things about the focus on smoking, obesity, nutrition, whatever.
One is, from the proof of concept point of view, those are areas where the evidence is pretty good for the kind of non-clinical, as well as clinical intervention. So that's another reason for starting there. The other thing is, another reason for kind of starting there and not ignoring the outcomes, but focusing on the measures of those things, is because sometimes, take lung cancer as a result of smoking. You don't see changes right away because of the latency period, but you see changes in the smoking behavior sooner, and that's a useful property of the measure.
Sarah?
I think I wanted to build upon Matt's response a little bit, because I think health plans are looking for this type of measure for a number of reasons. One is resource direction. And, you know, health plans either have a foundation or other mechanisms that we're working in communities. And in order to evaluate our efforts in the communities, we need to look beyond our membership. And in order to do that, we need some kind of public basis for measurement so we can say this is how we're tracking when it isn't our internal data. And so I specifically run an entire health index off CDC data. Not ideal. Sometimes due to periodicity, sometimes due to, you know, just other data aspects of what we get out of our public health system. But we need something like HEDIS for the public health side. And then, you know, and exactly what Matt said is there has to be a way to evaluate our efforts on each of these essential areas of population health or public health or health determinants that aren't out there right now. And even the existing measures in obesity and public health, I mean, they're very much down the road of did you measure BMI, not what is BMI.
Larry, and then Kurt?
I was really interested in your comment, Helen, about that communities could respond to these issues as well as medical institutions. And the first question that came up is, how would they know about them? Why would they be interested in responding? Why would this in any way feel relevant to them? And I feel like the comments about Kaiser's partnership and CPPW provided at least some of the answers that I think we really need to think about if we're going to move this constructively. Which is that the best way to reach them probably is through linkages. And to really then think about what's going on in those community benefit efforts of Kaiser, for example, or in CPPW or SUNY Community Transformation Grants, and how do we align with that and with that way of thinking. So, for example, the word obesity, which probably brings up BMI notions and, you know, certain kinds of goals versus the word nutrition versus the word food system. And food system of the three is the furthest from the medical side, but in some ways is going to bring up the most constructive community solutions, because food system will then talk about the work Frank and I were discussing earlier in Philadelphia of, using economic development dollars to increase the number of supermarkets, which has now been adopted by the Obama administration and it's going nationwide, is not necessary. You know, in that case, it's maybe kind of tied to obesity, because obesity has kind of become a national theme. But I think we have to consider very carefully what frame we're looking at, because I personally don't want the frame to be measurements of BMI. I think that's a terrible mistake which has misguided community, because it leads people very much to an individual solution. And we already have a medical individual paradigm, and in order to make community-wide change, thinking again about the fundamental question of what outcomes we want to achieve, you know, I think we have to flip that. But I do think that the partnerships and the work going on there may be really instructive to us.
I wanted to ask Andy a question. If we take Matt's idea of thinking about outcome measures in addition to these determinants of health, these process measures, what would be measures that would be engaging to the business community? Helen gave an example, actually, of one that was about missed school days. So something like missed work days would be relevant for employed people. But in even beyond that, like in Cleveland, where we have less than half of our students graduate from high school, we don't have a very prepared workforce. Is there something that could be measured as an outcome measure that would engage partners that we don't currently have at the table, just thinking about the clinical systems and the public health systems, things that could engage other sectors of government, voluntary agencies, and particularly the business community?
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, I think it's at two levels, because I do think, you know, there is a defined population for an employer itself, you know, and that is their workforce, their dependents. And you could create accountability measures for employers working with other partners, including healthcare plans, SARA, the provider community, community resources. It could really impact the health improvement of that defined population that a lot of employers feel responsible for. In fact, they would say is increasingly a business imperative for them to be competitive. Health and productivity, workforce health and productivity improvement is related to competitiveness of their industry. When you start to move into, you know, community-wide measures, I do think things like overall economic development issues, things like the quality of the school system, again, because in the minds of business leaders, there's a direct relationship there to, again, their enterprise and the creating the conditions for them to be successful in a marketplace. I do think you can engage them at that level, too. So, you know, I think it's much easier right now, and we're seeing huge investments by employers in workforce health and productivity issues. It's a bit of a leap to get business leaders more involved in community-wide collaboratives, although Matt and others, that's exactly where our business and health coalitions are focused. I mean, we've done a lot of work on worksite activities. And by the way, some measures on worksite activities, though, would be very useful to the employer community. You know, what are the best practice intervention strategies for employers at the worksite? But again, I think our larger interest here is to get community involvement at community level. Employer involvement.
There are, though, in Iowa, there's a very large coalition organized by the business community. WellPoint is one of them, but then the other non-health business community to create a coalition to create healthier people. They're going after obesity, tobacco, and things like that. So there are, as you said, they see it as a business imperative. And then Oklahoma City, the mayor, has taken it on a revitalization project designed to make walkable, livable communities instead of target of, I can't remember, £1 million, how many millions of pounds that people would lose in that city, and they're about 800,000 pounds they've lost or something. So political leaders see it, business leaders see it, so I think there would be pretty broad-based interest in the right measures.
And I think there are plenty of examples where actually the business community is taking a leadership role in community collaboratives. I mean, one of our coalitions, Mid-America, is in charge of the Healthy Community project and effort. So,
Jackie and Sarah?
In terms of a practical measures and users of these measures, so you think that the business, in the same way that we have those LEED buildings that a business would be interested in using an NQF criteria to be a NPP employer or something like that? That kind of a...
Yeah, there actually is a employer wellness certification process like the LEED. It's called Health LEED that has gone through an alpha testing, it's going through beta testing now. Some major corporations. Andy's on the board. I chair that part of that group. It's funded actually largely by the private sector. Target's put in $1 million a year to fund it. United has
public reporting capacity.
It's a certification process for employers, and we went through it as an alpha test, and I thought we were good, and we got a provisional. So it is really robust system around wellness, not just around, you know, because the hierarchy I see in employers, they first start out with how do we lower our premium, and then they start doing health fairs, and then they start perhaps doing disease management. And then they start to develop comprehensive programs for their employees, and then ultimately, the most sophisticated ones recognize that their dependents, retirees, are living in the community, their customers are, and so they actually branch out and reach out to the entire community. You have to be pretty high up on that scale to get the certification, so the process is in place.
Excuse me, Yvonne mentioned this in her slide presentation and also in the paper, but I'd just like to, you know, remind folks that Healthy People 2020 seems to be another big body of work where there are targets on population health measures, and I know the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, where I formerly worked, I don't work there now, is doing a lot of work on implementation, and the idea is to get this down to the community level. So I don't know if that's another source where we could look for some population health measures. And let me mention that they, you know, that work has all been based on social determinants of health, disparities and equity issues, and it doesn't address just clinical issues, but there are, you know, all kinds of things on access and, you know, other issues. I think worksite is part of that. So, again, just something else that exists that might be helpful.
So you know, there's so many products out of HHS that are released in parallel. So somehow we have to think about whether anyone in HHS could sort of do a crosswalk of all those things, or whether the LA group could, or whether someone has a PhD student who could. It's a huge body of work.
I mean, Dawn has indicated that that's actually been part of what she's already been working on, is that crosswalk. So we'll make sure that's part of the paper.
So it seems to me that there is some perhaps consensus around this notion of whatever the words are, smoking, obesity, exercise, were the original words used. I think we should pick the words we want to use if we want to decide if that's the place to begin. Forget the words. Is that the right? Do people agree with that as a starting point? Matt?
I think if we have a model or a framework in which those measures sit that describe influence on population health outcomes, just selecting them without explicitly articulating that framework, I think would be very problematic.
I think I call these topical areas from which to do the work within, not...
Well, but what I'm saying is I think something different in that we pick these because of their causal influence on population health outcome measures that we care about. And I guess I would still be uncomfortable with only selecting those determinants without articulating the downstream population health outcome measures of mortality related or disability related.
The CDC, I don't know when they first published it, but they do have a chart frequently referred to in public health papers where, yeah, the leading quote causes of death, you know, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and those. And then they have the underlying causes of death, of which tobacco, actual cause of tobacco, and then it is nutrition, poor diet, and then physical activity, and I think alcohol abuse is the next. So that is well established, at least in the public health work, and I have to assume there's a research case behind coming up with that. I can't quote it. So that is a framework that's, at least in the public health world, very well established.
It's a pair of articles by McGinnis and Sagi.
Yeah.
That did that. But I'd like to build on what Matt said, is that we need a rationale for choosing these things. And part of it is that it's embedded in a causal framework that leads to outcomes that are important. And that's part of the evidence there. But it's also looking upstream. We know that there are interventions that can make a difference, and there's evidence there as well. So it's part of a causal framework that we know that we can do something about, and that will get us to where we want to be.
I wonder if we're serious about the idea of this as a proof of concept, if there's something else besides even embedding those in a causal framework that we should do, and that's to maximize the diversity of the types of approaches. And I still wonder if, this is partly a question for you, Helen, if it would be worthwhile to think about a different kind of thing that is more of an outcome. It's not about us saying, okay, we're really smart, the folks at HHS are really smart, and these are three really good things to do, that good things will happen if you intervene on them. if it's about saying, let's see how it could reframe everything if you chose something that's a functional health type of measure, and said, we're going to develop measures of this. We're going to say, here's the concept, here's some measures that are available, not over-specify who uses the measures, saying that there will be different levels of groups that will use this. Some could be community measures. Some could be a whole state might decide to use some measures. Someone might be an employer. It might be a health plan. And say, we're going to look at the functional health status of our people. We're going to measure that. And then we're going to get together and take a whole systems approach and say, who needs to be at the table to, in our whatever level, whatever community, whatever group, to do something about that. And I just wonder if that would be an interesting contrast to these others, that we might learn something interesting that could inform the next steps.
I was actually going to say something similar when Matt was making his earlier comment, that there's also nothing that says that we can't, as part of the call, ask for both the determinants as well as outcomes. I think we just need to be tight in what we're asking for, because I think otherwise the universe could stream in and you'll be working on this committee for the next 6 years. So I just think really being focused would be helpful. So actually our staff had done a sort of quick and dirty review of what we thought were out there in terms of population health measures. And again, measures like these, there's a measure CDC has on avoidable mortality, 45 to 64. I mean, might that be a nice framing to bring in some of the determinants and allow some of these more general measures that could be used at a community level in these consortia to get at the outcomes piece faster? I think the functional health status stuff is a little more difficult because it's patient-reported, the whole other project beginning on that. There's so many other feasibility issues, et cetera. I think somebody, it just really would intrigue me to have you guys just think about whether you want to actually consider a small set of those outcomes as well.
It doesn't have to be patient-reported. I mean, there are community reports of this kind of measure.
Nor do I think we should rule out patient-reported. My favorite quote from John Mayer is, if you want to know how Mrs. Smith is doing, unfortunately, you're going to have to ask her. That single question self-perceived health, reliable, valid, predictive, easy to gather, used in all of the national health surveys, including BERPIS. Why not consider something like that? We're talking about measuring health. What about a measure directly of health?
I think the United Health rankings do have a couple of questions in it, one on perceived health and one on mental health, I think.
They do, and so do the county health rankings.
Yeah, those are
derived from the United, so, yeah. We've been talking about at least two things simultaneously, or sort of in parallel. One is what to measure, which is the determinants and outcomes conversation. And then sort of woven in that conversation has been, how will we determine whether they're good measures or not? And there have been two or three different sets of criteria proposed for how we would determine whether they were good criteria or not. And one are the criteria that NQF has traditionally used. And then there's at least one other set of criteria, which are the consensus standard on quality and public health system. The aims that are there is the second one, and maybe there are some others that have been mentioned as well, because the work of this committee is to, from whatever population of measures are proposed to it, to use some structured framework to arrive on what the committee will ultimately endorse to be used by whoever chooses to use them. And so both of those things have to be created before we're able to get to that last step of being asked whether we want to endorse them or not. Is that sort of what's been going on here?
I think so. I mean, I think that's part of how we began the discussion about the NQF evaluation criteria. We then talked about how the influence of the public health criteria fit in, and I think our goal would be that at the end of this process, you would have a version of the evaluation criteria we would use, the RNQF, that incorporate in some of those key elements you think are going to be really important to assess public health measures. So I think it's going to be a blending, which is why we just started the discussion today about the evaluation criteria. But you're right, you can't look at these measures until you have some basis to figure out how you're going to determine if they're a good measure.
Okay.
I'm not sure a process matches the outcome. I don't quite know how you get from a large group discussion with 20 people to the how-to. I mean, that seems like it's a smaller group activity. And how can we help get there?
Yeah, we are an hour into our conversation. It was at the same point. I would love to know what people think. What do we just conclude, accomplish, move on in the last hour? And if we are going to take the next hour, and we need it, where should we be going in the next hour? Does anybody want to hear a crack at that?
So, given that this document is that DHHS characteristics of quality in the public health system have been developed by consensus, could we look at these nine and say which of them we think are suitable to be NQF criteria? Are there some that are better than others and that would help us, that would be worthy of including? Does that seem reasonable? This has been, work has been done on this thing.
It's like the five aims. It's the correlate of public health of the aims for clinical medicine. And I think we, over time, want to make sure we hit each of those.
So Bobby and Jackie are suggesting, Bobby and Jackie now suggest a process where some group does, either we take existing work or some subgroups do some work and present us with a set of alternatives. And it's hard for a group as large to, you know, we kind of give them a lay of the land, but to really nail it down to something we're going to choose between and weigh the alternatives, there needs to be some intermediate work that it sees.
I'm in favor of separate.
So, to what degree are the LA folks going to do that?
It's not clear how much we're engaged in specifically in the evaluation criteria, but something we should follow up with them to make sure we're not being duplicative. And the other question is whether it's a group who actually could help work with LA on some of these issues as well.
Yeah, I think we should be worried about sending LA off by themselves to come back with something. We really need to meet together with them. It's a shame they can't be here today to really hear what's going on and inform it. But I don't think they're going to be the sage that comes back with the answer.
Well, the third area, and I'll describe two things we've been talking about, the other, and maybe what we're doing is framing out what it is we'd like to see. It's what we talked about at the very start of the conversation. We don't know what we're talking about because we don't share a set of definitions when we don't use language the same way. So we want to make sure that what we get back at least has those three parts to it, so that Kurt, then when the group is ultimately doing its work, it knows exactly, here's what we're talking about, here's how we're going to, here's the frame through which we'll select measures, and here's the process that we'll use to do that selection. We don't, and that's not all nailed down yet, it seems to me.
I guess I just lift my hands up to agree, but it's, a framework or a model on which we could hang measures and distinguish between determinants and outcomes and show how the measure set that we prioritize or how we prioritize the measure set fits with that framework. It seems fundamentally important. Otherwise, it just seems like laundry list or random, you know. It likely leads to measures of things like nutrition and smoking and exercise, but it seems much more comforted in sort of arriving at that conclusion after a framework in which we could point to how these fit in the causal pathway.
You know, I think that there's probably something like that in most NQF measures that's implicit. You know, structure, process, outcome, kind of thinking.
But given that the nature of this population problem, I think it helps to be explicit about these kind of things. So I would support that as well.
And so thoughts about the framework in which to hang the measures on, distinguish between determinants and outcomes, and prioritize among them. Thoughts about where we would derive such a framework? Is this a small group to go away and do this? Or would it be the nine aims?
I mean, I think part of my issue is I'm a very visual person. And I hear a lot of stuff, but I can't see it. I don't see like charts and boards. They might be interesting to get those charts back. I think they were here earlier. To start writing what would be in the framework for population health. And everybody just start throwing everything up on the wall. And then we can start kind of cutting some things out, piecing them together, linking them. But it's just really hard to look right in the middle and can't see it.
Yeah, it's also a lot easier to react to something than to create it, especially in a big group like this. So maybe the subgroups are the step that we need. So let's think about where we go now in the next hour, which could be on with the agenda and finish an hour earlier, or is there a way we can use this time now to move forward on this notion of framework?
Oh, could I also ask? I'm sorry. Over here. Yeah.
I didn't know your voice was coming from.
It's the voice of God. Do we want to answer these questions to help decide about the next step, or do we want to do the next step in terms of breaking out?
What's the pleasure of the group? Take a look down at these five, I believe, questions. We're deciding where to, and this is an open process, okay? I just got appointed like a few hours ago to chair this thing, so you're all more qualified than me. So let's talk about where we want to go with this. I mean, we you know, if it's the framework we're looking at, I mean, we pretty much either can adopt an existing one, if one, or think about what attributes would a framework have.
I wonder whether if we have maybe three different groups and three different measures and gave the groups the ability to focus specifically on the measure, say nutrition, for example, or food or whatever we want to call it, or the ability to kind of raise some of the meta questions, and we each took a half hour in our groups to kind of, because it feels like we have some dialogue, we could come up with some real constructive ideas, and then we could mesh it, and it feels like we're a little stalled here, because on the one hand we're dealing with very big ideas, and on the other hand we're dealing with a lot of specificity.
Well, I'm kind of struggling with, I guess, like you, where to go next. The American healthcare rankings and the county health rankings have a really nice framework that you can look at, put on the wall, and I'm not saying we have to use that one, but that's one to start with, where you could put the measure framework, each of the measures in there, and you'd know where they sit and what the causal pathway would look like.
Right.
And I have it on my little iPhone here.
And I would say the county health rankings have a similar type thing. Yeah, both. I mean, both. But I would also, I thought you were going to mention this before, but, you know, another, it is community, it's also personal, but another index and goes along with not just health, but also well-being is HealthWays and Gallup's well-being index, which really gets down, and we talked about this at MPP, but, I mean, really gets down to individual level, but also can be brought up to the community level. It's also the one thing that has one of the huge benefits is real time. I mean, this happens daily, every single night. And a lot of changes can be done with that as well. So, I mean, that's another, those are the really the three, I think, that we have now, the state health rankings, the county health rankings, and the well-being index to actually look at community health and well-being. I'm not sure besides the, you know, the BRFSS and the other data and stuff like that. But all those are derived from BRFSS, but the bigger frameworks.
Some of the questions, if we were going to spend the next half hour in small groups so people can talk and show and think, some of the questions we have on the table are the
the what, and we've chewed on that a fair amount about the three health behaviors. The how, which involves perhaps developing a framework that's more theoretical, and then the how also about the measures, and then there's implied for a who. But if we were, let's take a few minutes, if we were going to do small groups, what would this small group would be about, what would be the charge be?
Postprandial narcosis.
What if each of the wasn't broken into three separate groups, used either the county or the state health rankings as the framework, and then just use it as something to bounce ideas off of, to try to work it through for each of the individual areas. And then the three groups come back together to report out on what they were able to find that they thought needed to be changed, what needed to be added, what would work well, and what additional ideas it generated. We should perhaps I just go eat some more cake and be quiet for a few more minutes.
No, I'm again thinking about what is the outcome we're trying to reach here. And yes, we really do need to know from INCREB what is you're looking for here. But the community United Health rankings and the county health rankings are based on United Health rankings. Those, that's a fairly complex framework that's weighted and has attributes under that may change from year to year, hopefully not. So I'm not sure that's, to me, that's not striking as exactly what we're looking for here.
I think I don't mean for us to mirror them. I'm just trying to get them to use them as something to get the conversation going for the next step. It seems to be stopped.
I mean, I think what we're looking for is a shared vision of the criteria to use with rankings. And by actually doing the rankings, it may make it more concrete, which is why I agree with that recommendation. I don't think we'll exactly do that. I think what's important is to have open conversations where we kind of work at this and then kind of come back, and hopefully the clarity of different groups will support and mirror one another. If we do that for a half hour, we then have some time to kind of have some shared conclusions.
Mike and Bobby and Matthew and us.
Maybe this is just what you were just saying in a different way, that the question could be, to what do the county health rankings, can they serve as the framework that we need for this activity? Why or why not? So that would help us think through what attributes we like and don't like.
Good.
I also think it would be useful to actually have a group who wants to think about framework and whether some of the existing frameworks exist. And I think one group could do that, and whether it's applicable for what we're trying to do today. I still think it'd be useful to have a group who's would like to help us think through this issue of how you would evaluate these and how do we kind of reconcile what we've already got on the NQF side, perhaps the public health side. And then I guess the third thing is it also potentially to have a group who's going to think about scope, because we keep having this discussion about how broad we want to go. Maybe that's just a simple way to get something quite concrete out of it that might be useful in a half-an-hour discussion.
The groups of framework, how we evaluate and scope?
So I've become a collector of these frameworks just for fun, and have developed my own sort of synthesis of them. So I think sharing the frameworks, including the county health rankings, is going back to Evans and Stoddard, probably would be useful and would be a way for this group to take a framework and build and adopt one. I don't know that we can do that during the next 15 minutes, but I'd be happy to work with a subgroup on that.
Yeah, perhaps, because again, we're going to need to provide people with something to look at, something to react to, and I don't know, again, we need the next 15 minutes either, so maybe we should think about it as a next step, a subgroup, maybe telephonically or webinar, meaning what your webinar. And perhaps these are the three groups you propose. One to look at the different frameworks. And we already have a co-chair for that one, or a chair for that subgroup. And now the other two groups you mentioned.
Evaluation and scope.
Evaluation and scope. Are there those who have an interest in those?
Which, since we need to look forward to having a call for measures and a way to evaluate them. So those seem like the two other very concrete things we'll need to have people engage in. I think just because I do a lot of work on how to choose measures, what measures to use, where we get them, evaluating measures is an area I'd really like to be involved in.
Okay, Ms. Sarah is sharing that one. Who's the next person who wants to speak?
Are you next in line, Ron?
Yeah.
Okay. So when I was evaluating the measures, that we had to score, the question that was the most meaningful to me, coming from a public health background, was the feasibility question on the usefulness for public reporting. And that question really puzzled me because it didn't seem like the meaning of public reporting for that question was, can a health plan or anybody else who's using this measure put up on their website, that's the public reporting idea. I thought that that's what that meant for these measures. But that's not the public reporting idea that I have in my mind coming from the public health system. It's what value would these things have for the public to know about, not how do I evaluate this health plan, but how am I going to, what does this mean for me living in society and my health? This idea that how am I doing as a person living in society as I make my choices? So many of these measures they don't really have a lot of meaning for people living in communities. They have more meaning for entities that are providing services.
Which is interesting, looking at the room, and I don't think we have a consumer representative here. Obviously, we're all consumers, but they're per se. And interesting that most of the clinical measures are designed for clinical entities who are steeped in this kind of work. If we're going to do population health measures, one of the consumers of this ought to be consumers and the general population, or parks and recreation, transportation, mayors, people like that.
Yeah,
and yet we don't have
people
to table.
I didn't have any way to compute that question. That question really puzzled me and bothered me a lot in this. And so anyway, that's another one of those.
So we have our third chair of the evaluation. Scope. Okay. So evaluation. So you're on that committee. It sounds like scope in terms of where is the appropriate entity to be measured or measure themselves by these. Did you?
So
scared everyone away now.
I think I belong in the remedial class because I'm still struggling on question number one. And I'm thinking about the measures and their application. And I'm thinking about the issue of one of the criteria, which is disparity, another feasibility in terms of data. And so if I had a measure around nutrition, and I were Kaiser Permanente, and I had my defined community, I'm likely to have my data, and I probably could define disparities within my own community. I might be able to, maybe. And I could address that. And the measure would be fine, and I could use it, and I could make something of it. On the other hand, if I were a county, and my data sources are quite limited, I had the purpose, and I cannot really tease out of that disparities, and I can't really tease out of that more real-time data to deal with the particular issue, the measure might not be all that meaningful to me. And so I'm wondering how we deal with this issue. Which population of populations are we focusing on? I came into this thinking the population of a community, defined potentially geographically. Then there's the community that's defined by a business or defined by a health plan. And I think the measures really, the feasibility issue, the disparity issue, the 9 HHS aims, whether it's vigilant, whether it's proactive, et cetera, really do vary a great deal by the type of community we're talking about. And again, so I don't know how to deal with that, but that's just something that's been going through my head for the past hour as we've been talking, because it's very, it measures mean many different things to many different communities.
So this is the scope question you're now chairing.
So two things. One is I want to be on the MASC committee, the framework.
But two, to Jackie's point, I think about these measures as tools for managing the population health system, not for thinking about how I behave as a person to improve my own health. And I think that it's important to keep that in mind. I worked on Healthy People 2000, so that was quite a long time ago. But one of the things that kept on coming up was this was a way to communicate to the public about how they should behave with respect to bodies and so on. I don't really think that's true. I really think it's about how we manage the system that we should be focusing on.
Great. If we were going to have these three committees, framework, evaluate, and scope, let's just see who would be on them. Who would be on framework? No. Yeah, just for what you've heard. So framework, evaluation, and scope. I don't want to make a big deal. I didn't want to do a 30-second job. So who would be on framework based on what you know? We have about six people. How about evaluation? Health and evaluation measures. Four. Okay, so four or five. Scope. So it could work.
So it's probably okay because we'll all come up with interesting things. They are related to each other.
Right.
Fundamentally related to each other. But it's all right. It may just be fuel this fire.
But also perhaps subsequent to the meetings, then the chairs of those might get together.
That's a great idea.
And then there could be another iteration actually to say, wait a minute, compared to what they said, we're all off or we're 100% correct.
So, and not to procrastinate that, but we do have, I guess, contractors will be on the point of three. We've been working hard and deserve a break before that. What if we started a little bit late tomorrow and had a lunch or had a breakfast, groups of breakfast thing of these groups to get started tomorrow morning?
I don't really have to be precise about the 3 o'clock. I think we're probably okay, Elisa. So give us some guidance then.
You want to start it a little earlier today?
I'm just saying, I think we should just do it if we can.
Yeah, they'll be here at 3, so they'll be waiting, listening in, so it's fine.
It's fine. That's what I'm saying. I think it's fine to go a little bit longer this afternoon on this discussion, and it's important before we get to the measures.
Do people have energy for that now, to break up, or would you let it do it over breakfast?
I think we're also losing some folks tomorrow, so I prefer to get some of this foundational work done today.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is get the groups together right now, trying to define what their scope is for their group, right?
Yeah.
Is there a chart or whatever?
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
So, we can have...
Why don't we do that? Your group meets for 25 minutes or so, take a little break after that. If we come back at 3 and do a brief report back and start a little bit late, is that doable?
Okay, so Matt, you were doing the framework. Sarah was the evaluation methods for evaluating the measures, and Ron was doing the scope. Okay. Each of you want to find a spot here?
I was going to say, you guys are all right there. Why doesn't somebody come over to this side?
We have the areas back here and back here.
Yeah.
Right.
So, 5 minutes is fine.
Let us know where you're going and let us hold your wallet.
So framework's already clustered over there. How about evaluation here and then scope over here? So scope to your right, evaluation to your left over here, and framework over there. Run that.
There you go.
What did I say for scope? Scope B.
let us reconvene.
So let's go ahead and do 2-minute report backs from each group for 3 minutes each.
2 minutes.
Any volunteers? Ron, are you ready for the scope group? Whoa, visuals. For the folks on the phone, we're reporting back from some small groups. We have 3 small groups to do brief report back, and you're missing phenomenal visuals here.
For the scope group, we looked at 3 different...
I'm going to start singing in a moment. You're really going to be in trouble. For the scope group, we looked at scope in terms of the actors and stakeholders. Secondly, the population that the measures would apply to, and thirdly, the scope in terms of the scope of the measures themselves, what they should address. So for the actors and stakeholders, oh, by the way, members of the group, just raise your hands so folks know that I was not responsible for this, but you all were. Okay. So the actors and stakeholders, you know, we determined that healthcare providers, insurers, payers, businesses, governments, community-based organizations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It really applies to organizations, individuals even, who wish to use and apply the measures. Which then gets to, well, what's the population we're looking at? And the group decided we really should be looking at geographically defined populations, not populations defined by individual organizations. And there was some discussion around that. And part of the rationale for that was that whether an individual is part of the health plan, whether an individual is in a business, the entire community, the environment of the community, the policies that affect the community, et cetera, affect the health of the individuals within the business, within the health plan, et cetera. So the group came to consensus pretty quickly that the community that the measures apply to should be geographically defined, not defined by organizations. Last but not least, scope of the measures. Clinical measures, behavioral measures, and community measures. A community, broadly defined, is environmental, socioeconomics, interventions / community services, and policies fall into that as well, and even community assets all fall into the community scope here. And then, pardon? Oh. and then the group ended up posing a question, which the question was more of a statement than a question. And the question was, given scope, given geographic population distinctions, maybe NQF should focus on community preventive measures, but that really should be the focus because so much work has been done on the clinical side. This is the time to make a case for and make a real mark and a real statement on community measures. What does community measures mean? Community measures could be things that affect the environment, policy, others, not clinical services. The Guide to Community Preventive Services, yes, the Guide to Community Preventive Services would have some of those measures in it. Group members wish to say I missed the boat?
Should I say that? I wasn't in your group. Sarah, do you want to talk about how you evaluate?
Why don't we take one question?
I have a three-part question. okay, I have to pick one. In the scope discussion, did you talk about the denominator, what the population is, and specifically if the population could be something other than a geographically defined population? Whoever was in the group.
We didn't discuss that explicitly. However, if one were to define the population geographically, then the denominator would be the, I would think, the population is in that geographic area, whether it's a block, whether it's a state, whether it's a nation, etc. But we did not discuss that specifically within the group.
I think they said it would be cutting it too fine, not over here. It would be cutting it too fine if you said a subgroup within a geographic group. I mean, you get too down to a level that you couldn't measure.
Although if you were looking at disparities within a population, you might have to do it more time to identify.
But you start in the geographic, and then you could do subgroup analysis after that.
Yeah. Okay, next, Sarah. I guess you're up.
You really want to refresh your question?
Well, so I, triple hit.
You know, we just didn't do the written report, but basically what our group was talking about would be starting the conversation about the evaluation criteria and how they might look different for population health or community health measures. And, you know, what we agreed to do is start with the criteria, you know, that Helen started discussing this morning and seeing how we may have to adapt those and when evaluating population health measures. Because for some of you who have performance measure background in looking at the measures that we reviewed for today and tomorrow, some things just don't fit as well. So we have to find this point of fit and unfit and how to define those types of things. And one way that we're going to do that is by looking at the consensus statement on quality in the public health system, although in our quick review that obviously has a lot of overlap with what we're already looking at as well as crossing the quality chasm. So trying to bring those all together to really define what we're going to look at. We talked a little bit about we're going to have to change, I don't want to say change the language, but maybe address the language disparities between the typical performance measurement translation of things to the public health type domain and on the way down to consumers, and how do we make this all transparent to make it actionable. And what we had started to do at the very end was using one of the examples of a public health measure. So from the National Vital Statistics Report, the percentage of premature death. And thinking about when you're looking at something that historically may have been a surveillance measure and we want to convert it, or there's an interest in converting it into being something that tells us a story that we can translate, that we can do something about improvement, how does that translate into criteria to evaluate? We had just started that discussion. So we'll have much more to report later.
Thank you. Matt, you can embed your questions in your presentation now. Can you use the mic, Matt?
So I mentioned that I collected these models, and you know, a lot of them you can trace historical roots to Evans and Stoddard. I came up with this just because there was something missing in all of them, and so this is just a framework that you know might be useful, and it moves basically from upstream to downstream, starting with these upstream determinants of genetic endowment, socioeconomic factors, physical environment, and then the first potential contribution of healthcare and prevention and health promotion upstream. When we're discussing it in our group, I think it was Larry who first said, you know, it's kind of cheating to have this box called socioeconomic factors because it's like everything else, goes in this box, and the group is talking about maybe having government programs and policies called out and maybe affecting the entire continuum here. But those are the upstream factors leading to individual risk factors shown here, behavioral risk factors, which lead to physiologic risk factors that can be measured in the health system, like blood pressure and glucose and BMI and things like that, and also leading to resilience and also affected by resilience. All of these factors influenced by the upstream determinants. These individual risk factors influence further downstream disease and injury, and that's mitigated, for better or worse, by medical care. The second potential contribution of the healthcare delivery system. So far, we're not talking about population health in this entire framework. And then downstream from there are the measures of population health. States of health, described here as death or self-perceived health and functional status, and even further downstream from there, well-being or quality of life. I think important to distinguish the measures of health from the intermediate outcomes. Two people with the same disease state or injury status may have very different levels of functioning or self-perceived health, and two people with the same functional status might have quite different self-perceived quality of life. There are feedback loops all throughout this framework that are important to take into account, that it's not a linear model. That, for example, well-being obviously has influence on socioeconomic status. And then over to the right, this is for sort of graphical purposes to show the distinction here between individual and population health, is that all of these factors, this bar says disparities, for all of these factors you can measure the distribution of health or distribution of these factors. It's not just the goodness, but the distribution, as we talked about earlier. So that's a framework, and it's one of many, I'll admit, but a framework on which you could hang the measurement activities we're talking about. So in the agenda so far, we picked two boxes: this prevention and health promotion box, and the behavioral risk factors box. But you can see in the broader framework, there are only two of the broader set of determinants and outcomes in health. And it might be useful, even if we land on things like nutrition and physical activity, to show that fits here, that influences this sort of causal pathway of influencing physiology and resilience, downstream determinants, disease and functional status, and then the things, probably more even more importantly, the things that affect those behavioral risk factors. And in our discussion, talked about if you pick a measure like what we talked about in terms of nutrition or smoking, you could go through the discipline of seeing how that in each of these domains, how measures in each of these domains have an influence and relate to the measure of smoking or physical activity. Just one last thing I'd add is that this is still obviously a highly simplified model and really still in the level of a logic model. There was some discussion earlier about the work of Bobby Milstein and Gary Hirsch and Jack Klemmer to develop a real functioning model, a simulation model of population health that we're now experimenting with in a couple of the triple aim communities. And so that actually measures what influences smoking status and what impact smoking status ultimately has on downstream outcomes over a period of 20 years in a community. So that's a much more sophisticated model. I think it's harder to use as a framework than this more simplified logic model. But I just wanted to point out that those more sophisticated models are out there as well.
All right, you have a comment, and then we probably should move on.
Sure. I mean, I'm very... Thanks, sir. I just thought this was very, very constructive. One of the questions that came up about it and also about the Los Angeles report was about the purpose of the documents. Because there's a different, and I think this works very well for our purposes. One of the questions we had is the, you know, the credibility factor. And, you know, and so it partly depends, is this to inform our thinking? In which case I think it works very, very well. Is it to disseminate more broadly to explain our thinking? And our bias was that we need to explain our thinking, and also that all the work that LA is doing, that a lot of that is valuable thinking and resource to the field. And I think someone commented earlier it's just internal, but I would certainly think that a lot of it should be disseminated, you know, or at least, you know, as part of a statement that's broader than that. And I think that's important to understand from the onset. In terms of the dissemination, I think one of the problems with this framework is that on the left-hand side, there's a small line, and that line is supposed to represent inequities and all the work that's done on inequities. There are a number of groups, Prevention Institute being one of them, Policy Link another, and a couple of others who've really looked at the underlying community issues to focus on inequities. And I would think we would want some kind of diagram that talks about the inequity strategy, maybe as an accompanying piece if it's going to go beyond this room, because I think it's very, very important that we stay dealing with inequities is incredibly important at the same time that we're dealing with overarching quality. And I really think the arrow, you know, is intended to do that, but from a visual perspective, I could see it as very diminishing to people who are not just thinking conceptually. And there is work in, you know, as I said, interesting, at one point, Policy Link and Prevention Institute were funded separately and didn't know about it to delineate the community factors related to equity and came up with almost the exact same list of factors. So it was almost like the scientific experiment. We did completely separate research but came up with the same answers. And I think it would be easy to turn those into a chart or something to kind of lay out the, you know, the kind of the community measure, the community efforts that require measures to have impact.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for your flexibility in putting that together. I think that will inform our work as we go forward. Should we move on at this point to next steps? Yeah, let's keep in mind, we're going to go through this next section here as a way of first of all, immunizations are a nice bridge between individual and population care, but also as a way for us to learn the NQF methodology, so we may apply it more broadly.
Maybe we don't answer it right now, but what's the now what of forming those three groups and then putting this out in a larger group? What do we do now?
Well, if that has to focus on the group, would it make sense for you to get together for an hour on a call and finalize this a little bit more so that you could then present it back to the larger group? So we can have that schedule between the chairs and the committees. Did anybody capture who was on what group? Or maybe we can put just send a sign-on list.
I still think there's a bit of a question based on what Keith was saying. And then when we do that, it's kind of how do we get traction from it? Where does it fit with other work? Right.
I think some of that will be our next steps about developing the call for measures. I think we'll also want to feed all this information back to the folks in LA to make sure that all we don't want them going off in a very different direction. So we'll be sure to share all this with them. And one question might be whether one of these groups or multiple want to actually have a conversation with them as well. I think the framework group in particular might be very useful.
Okay. All right. We're going to move into
sort of Inslee's traditional work by looking at measures of insulin and immunization. Now, because we know the slides are difficult to read earlier, we've also given you a printed version. So Sheila should have handed this out to you. So for those of you, we really do want you to be able to read this. So we'll have, you have both the screen, which I think is a little closer and a little easier to read, but also you have a written version and you can make notes. Also, what I should have appeared to see is one of these little gizmos. Okay, these are actually going to be little voting tools, and we'll show you how to use them when we get to that point. But it's a way of capturing a group vote on things. And so as we go through this, there will be opportunities to vote on things. And so take note that that's what this is for. Please don't take it with you. Just leave it at your seat when we're done today. All right. So what we'd like to do is talk about the first six measures of the 19 that are part of this project. And they all speak to influenza immunization. And if you notice, there are even two more on there, which at the bottom are two additional measures that are in the NQF portfolio as that were recently evaluated that are influenza immunization measures as applied in the nursing home population, both short stay and long stay. And I think the first thing that becomes very obvious is we're measuring one thing in, with eight different measures. And last week, we created the work groups to look at these measures more in depth in preparation for this meeting. And the work group members for this group were Jason and Mike, Amir, Jacqueline, and Linda. And we talked a lot about, you know, what's the deal with so many measures. And so we're going to be looking at these, but I think in the back of your mind, we want to, those are the kind of questions we want to ask. So you'll see that there are measures of, for influenza vaccination for healthcare personnel, for immunization of hospital patients, for home health patients, for outpatients, for the ESRD population, and then in populations over age 50. So there are different approaches, and it wasn't always quite, you know, this crazy. This actually is better than it was. But I'd like to pull out a table from NQF's more recent task force reports on harmonization about related and competing measures. I think we just looked at a group of measures that are certainly related. And if you look at the first column in the second row, which is about measures with the same focus but with different target populations, these are related measures. And sort of the directive or general sense or goal of NQF is to combine into one measure with an expanded target population or justify why different harmonized measures are needed. There is definitely a conversation and a need for trying to reduce this multiplicity of measures. NQF has worked in this space before. 3 years ago, we had a project funded by CMS to look at immunization measures for influenza and pneumococcal disease. And at the beginning of that project, there were 16 measures for influenza immunization. And that was just kind of craziness. Some of the measures were assessment measures. Some were how many patients were offered. And some were about how many actually were vaccinated. But the fact that there were all these variety of measures was just kind of crazy. And certainly the need for harmonization, by which we mean that the way it's measured, the specifications are all aligned, regardless of how you might use it in different settings or different populations, but that the measures could work together because they're aligned. Well, the 16 measures on the table, that committee was really thought, forced to ask the question, aligned to what? So they looked at essentially the current guidelines and the evidence and created sort of a basic what should a good measure look like. And those are what's known as standard specifications. And they created standard specifications for influenza immunization, healthcare personnel influenza immunization, as well as pneumococcal immunization. And essentially, the characteristics of those standard specifications were based on current ACIP guidelines and the evidence. They were focused on being comprehensive measures to include all recommended populations to the extent that they're measurable. So in other words, big denominators. And then they chose to specify numerator categories. And we're going to talk a little bit about why in just a minute. But within the numerator, rather than aggregating all of these types of patients, they recommend that these are separated and computed and reported separately. And those that actually receive the vaccine, those that decline the vaccine, and those with contraindications. And then the standardized time window of October through March. It was amazing the number of flu vaccination measures that had totally different time frames. September, July, February, everybody was in there. And that was kind of very, very difficult to sort out. The numerator categories resulted from really a thinking about comparing different approaches to typical measurement. And examples within those 16 measures had all of these. And this is a comparison of two sample providers with 100 patients. And the first row talks about what happens if you include in your numerator all patients that were vaccinated, those that declined the vaccination or had a contraindication of the vaccination, and all combined together without separating them. In other words, did the provider do the right thing? So one of those three things is a yes, they did the right thing. And as you can see, these two hypothetical providers had identical scores. But let's see what happens to those identical scores when we look at things slightly differently. When you look at the second row, it's the first row measure broken out into numerator categories, where you specifically break out those that actually received the vaccine, those that declined, and those that had contraindications, and report these individually. And as you can see, suddenly your two providers that look the same with the first row don't really look the same in the second row. Clearly, one of the most important goals and targets of measurement is to increase the number of patients who get the vaccine. And you can see that despite equal performance in one measure, many more patients got the vaccine with provider two than provider one, even though if you were measuring the aggregated performance, they looked the same. And this was an important characteristic that the previous committee felt was an important aspect, an attribute of the measure to provide this detailed information. Michael, do you have a question?
Just a comment. I like this example. I'm going to use it in my teaching on Thursday.
Okay.
But the other assumption here is that decline is a good outcome. And that may not be so.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that was a large part of the discussion. Clearly, this idea of specifying with numerator categories was really the focus of much of their discussion, because it was felt that the decline is something that's potentially actionable. But if you bury it in the aggregated score, like in row one, you really won't know that or won't be able to identify the actionability.
And, you know, and as we get more into populations, obviously, we're doing this, that becomes more important. And, you know, things like if they haven't been to the doctor, you may want to exclude them, but we may want to think about them very differently in a population setting.
Yeah. Intervene with that decline and give a personal example. Because I work in a healthcare institution and walk down the hall to our health group in the hospital, and they gave me my flu shot in our auditorium. And then I had a cold and went to the doctor, and he said, "You want your flu shot?" I said, "I already had it." So I'm in the decline category.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No. Not in the way the measure's constructed. Okay. Well, that's what we're going to go into more detail. So, but if you look at row three, which is a very common way for constructing measures, is to take your exclusions for things like decline and contraindications and remove them from the denominator. And you can see what happens to the measured population. Not only does your denominator shrink and you don't have a way of really monitoring how many people actually were assessed, offered, or, you know, attended to on for flu vaccine, it really does affect the measure result. And so you can see that having different approaches to measure constructs gives you very different results. And so standardizing the approach was an important milestone, if you will, towards aligning all of these different measures, if they're going to be coming from different settings or different data sources, so at least the construct is the same, so that ultimately, maybe if we move to common data sources, it should be a nice transition, and because the constructs are the same. So it was because of this that the steering committee landed on standardized specifications for influenza immunization, and essentially the numerator is the patients who fit into those three categories and report them separately during October through March. They had to pick the time frame because, again, they were not at all standard in the measures brought to us. And the denominator were the number of patients in, you know, whatever you're measuring, whether it's a facility, an agency, a practice, or a defined population such as a health plan during that time frame. And at the time, this was prior to the 2010 change in the recommendations for flu vaccine, but I've updated it so it's, you know, greater than age 6 months. So this is what the steering committee 3 years ago felt was a good representation of the type of measure, and they evaluated the existing measures against that. Very few measures actually met this standardization, and some of the measure developers at the time adjusted their measures, and some of them did not, but were told at their next maintenance review, which is now, that they would need to do so to maintain their endorsement. So there is a standard spec for influenza immunization, and there is one for healthcare personnel.
Have you looked at the October one? Because I hear probably like the August one at this point.
That's something I think could be discussed. At the time it was created, a lot of the discussion was around availability of the vaccine.
It's now available, at least in the community, and actually in July in some cases, but certainly by August.
Yeah. Sharon was actually the staff who struggled through this, and she can probably speak to that part better than
I him. Just want to mention that the way that they looked at it is that they would select the denominator population from October through March, but there would be a look back so that if the person actually received it in August, they would be considered as having received the vaccine. So, I mean, that certainly could have some adjustments, but I just wanted to assure you that they did count people who had received the vaccine earlier and you know, they recognized that, you know, it was becoming available earlier and earlier.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, the unintended consequence is it may not drive providers to start offering the vaccine or offering referrals to a place who has the vaccine as early as August.
Noted. Michael?
I've got a question at the other end of this time. This can't, two things. One is this can't be calculated until April, right? So is that an issue of the next year?
Because I think that you're right. You do wait until the time frame is over. But at the same time, the fact that not calculating it, you know, after a time frame has gone on, is very typical of measures in general. It's usually encounters during the year or something. Yeah. So there usually is some kind of a lag period that's very, very typical of measures. It's rare that you have a measure that can be done in real time.
Yeah, well, I mean, some measures you can, as you can, be done on January 2nd,
mm-hmm.
But this one can't be done to April 1st. That may not be a big issue. The other thing is that this gives as much credit to someone who gets his shot on February 28th as someone who gets it on October 1st, which obviously there's not as much protection from the flu. I guess there's nothing you can do about that.
Was there any discussion around populations who are traditionally underserved with regard to influenza vaccine, whether those are African American, Native American, lower socioeconomic status?
There was discussion around that, but in terms of changing the measure, you mean, or stratifying?
Or capture the health equity issue.
It's not reflected here, and that's a good question. It's something we struggle with all measures of how best to display that, and certainly the way we've looked at it to date is to try to report measures based on those particular population characteristics. But you know, frankly, that's not happening consistently. A lot of times, those kinds of data are not available in the same place as the clinical data. So, you know, certainly we're always looking for suggestions and recommendations regarding that.
So with that background, our task today is to look at these six measures. And this work group has looked at these, and we actually have some preliminary ratings from them that we'll share with you as we go through this. So on our agenda, the first measure we're going to look at is measure 431. It's the influenza vaccination coverage among healthcare personnel. And as I said, there is the standard specifications for that that is projected right now. But this measure looks at the percentage of healthcare personnel who receive the influenza vaccination. And I just want to take the opportunity to briefly talk about the evaluation criteria very, very quickly.
So just as we're doing this, as you said, this is kind of the normal work of NQA. I'm new to this process, and our group has been through this before. I think when we were setting this up, we talked about thinking about this as a way that we can learn about the process to which the population measures that we've been talking about, the other population measures that might be new, might be subjective. Bobby asked us to, as we're going through these, to think about how does this translate to the community, so we can even think about the extensions, which is part of our charge. How might these be extended from individual measures to population measures? Reva's going to go through some things now that will help us to not spend a lot of time having a nice discussion about things that aren't really going to change anything. So she's going to give us the criteria that all these measures are evaluated on, so we can really learn the larger process from that. And then we'll go through and try to apply this each one. And I think we're going to share the votes that were done before. And what we might be able to do is focus our discussion on things that might need to change. I mean, if a vaccine becomes available earlier, well, that's something that ought to be considered. Does this need to change? But these are all pretty well, today and tomorrow, pretty well established measures. A lot of detailed work has been done. So I think we can maybe focus our efforts and maybe even save some time, one, so we don't have to do follow-up phone calls to get through the rest of them. But two, maybe we can save some time to continue our other discussions, but then informed by having really gone through some of the existing measures. Is that all fair?
All fair. So saying measure 431, the influenza vaccination coverage among healthcare personnel, is a measure that's brought to us from the CDC, and we do have a representative from CDC on the line. And I just ask if they would like to just make any comments about the measure before we get started. We can hardly hear you, so you're going to have to really speak up.
Yes, that's better.
Okay, great. So I will just give some very brief comments about, as I think was referenced, this is a measure that had received previously a time-limited endorsement from NQF. So what I was going to do is speak extremely briefly about the pilot project that we did to test the measure and just give you an overview of the findings that caused us to make some changes in the measure so that it's what is under consideration today. So we conducted this pilot during the past influenza season. We recruited over 300 healthcare institutions to participate, and we had 234 of them that completed all of the surveys that we requested of them. There were 78 acute care hospitals, 59 long-term care facilities, 16 ambulatory surgery centers, 43 dialysis clinics, and 38 physician practices. So we had a variety of inpatient and outpatient facilities. And I'll go over this briefly because I know it's in the application that you all received. In general, we found that our inter-rater reliability in looking at the vaccination status using the measure was acceptable. And the faithfulness of the measure was acceptable. The specifications for the measure are the denominator includes healthcare personnel working, as was referenced, between October 1st and March 31st of the following year, regardless of their clinical responsibilities or patient contact. And the denominator is calculated in three mutually exclusive groups, the first being employees, the second being licensed independent practitioners who are physicians, advanced practice nurses, and physician assistants who are affiliated with the facility but are not employed directly by the facility. And then the final separate group is students, trainees, and volunteers. The numerator specifications, I think I don't need to go over because they were just discussed. It's those that meet the NQF consensus standards for measurement. So vaccination, whether it's received at the facility or outside the facility, declination of vaccination for non-medical reasons or a medical contraindication. One change that we did make there was to add a category for unknown vaccination status. The findings of our pilot were that facilities sometimes had difficulty tracking this in certain non-employee groups, and we felt that adding an unknown category would give them actionable data, which indicate a need for improvement in their tracking, and it would be more valid than calculating the unknown based on a simple difference between the reported numerator and the reported denominator. The major differences in the denominator statement between the measure that NQF had given a time-limited endorsement to and this measure that's under consideration now is that the non-employee groups are more curtailed. Although we generally had a good agreement in the measure, we did have facilities, both inpatient and outpatient, report difficulty in tracking the credentialed non-employees and their other non-employees, which initially included every single healthcare personnel, a healthcare worker in the hospital who was not an employee. And so based on that, we felt that it would produce a more valid measure to restrict those groups to, as I mentioned, the licensed independent practitioners and the students and volunteers, because it seems to be easier for the facilities to track. I think the only other major change that was made from the measure that had gotten a time-limited endorsement was the time frame. Initially, it was the healthcare personnel who were in the hospital, in the facility for at least one day during the influenza season, and now it's working for at least 30 days in the influenza season. That primarily is a concession to feasibility. We heard from our pilot facilities that it really wasn't possible for them to track, again, many of the non-employees who were in for only one day. And so the concern was that the data produced by the measure would not be valid if it were restricted to one day. And I believe that is everything in the way of background.
Yeah, can I ask a question? So, in other words, it's employees and contracted and health professionals and others who were in for 30 days or more during influenza. If a hospital outsources their food service or custodial services, does that mean that the food service workers and the custodians don't have to, custodial services do not have to have influenza vaccine?
Well, it doesn't mean that. It does mean that they would not be included in this measure, and we did have a lot of debate about that, and the feeling was based both on the people that were on our project steering committee and on the data that we got from our pilot, that it would be better to have a measure that was less inclusive but more valid than to have a measure that was more inclusive but included data on employees that are difficult to track and therefore might not be producing data that is a true representation of how that facility is doing in their vaccination program. But yes, your interpretation is correct.
So I'm curious about that category B in the numerator. I understand the issue there, but it strikes me, if I read it correctly, that you're counting those unknown status as if they had been vaccinated.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much for asking that. I should have stated specifically each of those categories is calculated separately. So this would allow an institution to use category A and produce a vaccination rate. And they could use categories E, C, and D to produce declination rates, contraindication rates,
and base of unknown assessment, and that's why it's actionable data. But thank you. Those would not be calculated as vaccinated people.
All right, thank you. And I believe of our work group members, Linda, I think you were the person assigned for this one. I just want to briefly review the evaluation of measures. The first criteria, I think if everybody recalls, is the importance of measure and report criteria. It has three parts, the high impact. And I can honestly say that in years of doing measure evaluation, I've seen very few where high impact doesn't pass with much thought. So I would ask that we won't separately vote on that, but if you feel that we're talking about something that doesn't have a high impact, please call it out. So the next one is the gap in performance, and the third one is evidence. Gap in performance can be defined in several different ways. Variability of overall performance, but here's where disparities is really critical, and we really do ask for to look at data on disparities if it is all available, because there are times when that's where the opportunity is, less so maybe in the overall performance. You do want to consider the data that's presented in terms of distribution and representativeness. And the third thing is looking at evidence. Key points is we're looking at the entire body of evidence, be nice if that measurement or if that evidence has been graded by one of the traditional grading systems, like with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force or GRADE. Expert opinion is not evidence, right? It's opinion. And so there is still room for expertise and judgment, but we do want to try and be as quantitative about the evidence as possible. We are looking for an assessment of the quantity, quality, and consistency of that body of evidence rather than just calling out one article or one study to base a measure on. So the work group did preliminary evaluations, and these are how they rated it. And Linda, do you want to take the discussion from here?
Sure. So as you see, three of us rated it, and we all said it's high impact. We all agreed that there was a performance gap in terms of numbers, the percents of healthcare employees who, healthcare personnel who have been received influenza vaccination. In terms of the disparities, there was actually no information about disparities, so that was a missing piece of information. I don't know whether it's been looked at or not, but it was not reported in terms of disparities among healthcare personnel. And you see the rationale there, 63% coverage in the past year. Should I go on? So,
sure.
In terms of evidence, quantity, which was five or more studies, was all rated as high, although there were four cluster randomized studies. I'm not sure how that got high, but I thought high had to be five or more studies. Yeah. I don't know what I did there. Quality looks like one rating of high and two of moderate. In fact, the information submitted by CDC itself rated the evidence as moderate because of some limitations and the fact that the studies that are cited are done in long-term care facilities as opposed to acute care settings. And so there's some gaps in the evidence in terms of effectiveness of immunization of healthcare providers in acute care settings. But the studies that have been done are all internally consistent, and so thus consistency was rated as high.
Any comments on the ratings the work group presented?
So just a question. So where does the issue of the data, the quality of the data, come into play?
That comes under scientific acceptability.
Okay. And the data are self-report? Or facility verified?
I'm not totally sure. I would guess these were verified. I don't know that for sure.
Hi, folks from CDC, can you answer your question about your data source?
The data source is
know for your measure that you tested?
The measure, there were table images for you, but the, it was intended on the health report, to be electronic health medical records, to be an occupational registry or database with the hospital that the committee compiled.
Okay.
How do you take into, and this is the process overall question, how do you take into account that there is no data on disparities provided? Does that affect the ranking in any way, or is this just something you gloss over and say, okay?
I think that will depend on how you want to approach it. Certainly, lack of information around disparities could certainly cause your rankings to be, or your ratings to be lower. We've had steering committees in the past who basically required information around disparities before they would move a measure forward. So, it depends on how strongly the committee feels on that criteria.
And the disparity wouldn't necessarily have to be disparity among the healthcare workers. It could be disparity among the population served by those healthcare workers. It may be that lower facilities serving lower socioeconomic individuals have lower rates than those serving the very wealthy. From CDC, can you respond to that? What would it take to provide some kind of information on disparities among influenza, disparities among people served by healthcare facilities with regard to immunization rates?
Population, not the healthcare personnel?
Yeah, because I think we're interested in people being protected when they go to a healthcare facility.
Right. I know that my colleague, Dr. Ahmed, is on the phone, and he may want to jump in on that as well. I'm not aware, based on my knowledge of the literature, that studies of that manner have been done. I know there have been studies talking about the quality of care provided to patients in practices that serve mostly lower socioeconomic versus higher socioeconomic patients in terms of the physician's education and training. I don't know that studies of that manner have been done among healthcare facilities, particularly hospitals. Is it necessary that the disparity that's in question, is that specifically looking at socioeconomic disparity?
Could be racial, could be ethnic, could be geographic.
I guess the question is because the interpretation that we have been thinking of going through this process is that the real disparity that you see, although this is among the healthcare personnel and not their patients, is based on their occupational category. And we even found in our study data that employees had a higher, significantly higher vaccination rate versus some of those other non-employee categories.
Yes. If you look at unnatural causes, that still outlies that extremely well at the university hospital. So that is another disparity. If that's an easier one to get at, because it would probably reflect the disparity in the population being served.
Right. It would certainly reflect disparities in the amount of protection given to patients based on the type of healthcare personnel they were interacting with. But I don't know if that is exactly what the committee is looking for.
For approving these measures, is what's more helpful? If the measure's otherwise sound, is it more helpful to not approve it because we don't have data? Or is it more helpful to approve it with some suggestions like Paul just made? I mean, he really outlined some very interesting categories it could be reported on, and which is more helpful to the process.
It seems to me this is far too important a measure not to pass. But the question is, it's got to come around in 2 or 3 years. We may not be there, but can there be a strong recommendation that when it comes back around, that there is clearly good evidence presented about how this is measured and the impact in disparate, whether it's job categories in the hospital, which tracks really well. Those people live in the same communities. You can draw the line out as other populations subject to disparities, or whether it's in the population served. But is it?
Yes.
absolutely. You can certainly make all the recommendations, and I think that as NQF really pushes this whole issue around disparities, providing very focused recommendations to a developer on what those disparities really should be, which ones should be addressed, I think is an important role for this committee to play.
So it seems that it doesn't affect the fact that those data aren't available doesn't affect the quality of this measure itself, but it's a recommendation for use of the measure that we would make. I mean, but the measure is still reliable and valid without, even if we don't know those answers. Is that not right?
Well, if looking at it from the point of view of protecting our patients or in the hospitals or long-term care facilities, it's probably a much more vulnerable population because the vaccine may not even work on them. But the question is who you spend more time with. I mean, you know, if in fact your doctors and nurses are vaccinated, but you see your food service worker three times a day, and your custodian spends 15 minutes, or what are they not called, environmental service, whatever it's called now, spend 15 minutes in your room, you actually have far more contact with them than you do that doctor who you're lucky to see 15 minutes a day. So it may not be a valid measure of how well patients are being protected if we're not looking at those people who actually spend more time with you, who are handing you your food. And then the other thing that really bothers me is if you're allowed to outsource that to food service providers or environmental companies and therefore wipe it out of the equation, then you really have unprotected patients.
Okay.
That's
interesting.
It's also very reasonable to include
it. Can I just clarify one thing? The issue about the contract outsourcing, and it is very broad flexibility for those or environmental professionals are directly paid by the facility. If they're employees, they would be counted in the employee category.
So Michael, is your moment gone? So the actually there and then Michael and then Ron.
I just had a question about the comment Paul was making, because I strongly agree that there needs to be a stronger equity component in it. I was just wondering, though, if the responses, well, the studies haven't been done, whether there's something that has to be addressed now around some kind of study or some kind of modeling, just to say 3 years from now that's going to have to be dealt with, or we're recommending to a group it's going to have to be dealt with. I imagine they'll get the exact same answer 3 years from now as now. So I'm not quite sure what the implementation or whether there's a set of recommendations, but somehow we need some work to be done so that we have the resource. But the inequities, I mean, my experience is continually the answer with inequities and with community strategies is we don't have that kind of information. We haven't done that kind of study, and that's exactly the problem. And that's why we end up with using the wrong or weaker information from a community and equity perspective is because the studies are never done, and I would hope we could do something about that, but I don't know what it is.
So I'm all in favor of gathering data on disparities and equities, and I'm sure that if we did the kind of thing that Paul suggested, we'd find them. But on the other hand, if you look at the measures here about performance gaps. I mean, the licensed providers are less than 50% are vaccinated. It strikes me that by itself makes it important enough that even if there were no disparities, we want to have this measure.
Yeah. How strong are our recommendations? How strong is the influence of the recommendation from the committee? Is it a good idea kind of a thing that may or may not actually come to pass? Or is it something that we can tie to you are endorsed with the contingency that this be accomplished by X, Y, and Z date?
So you find all measures, for instance, are evaluated every 3 years. So you can make a very clear statement that the next time this measure is up for review, there's an expectation that data stratified by population served and or I think the employees would be required.
And as a matter of process, I believe, and I'm sorry, the speaker on the phone, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, I really apologize. What is it? Megan. But I think you said that this received either a provisional or a temporary last time around, not a full endorsement. And what we didn't hear as a group is why. And so we actually are not able to evaluate what had to change.
Actually, that's a standard part of our process, which we're not doing as much anymore. things are applying time-limited endorsement because they haven't yet been fully tested. So the measure is now fully tested, so it is up for full endorsement for the next 3 years.
Okay. So it's a question whether it's fully tested if it hasn't had these disparity measures.
So disparity testing is not a required part of the testing. We're testing for reliability and validity of the measure properties.
So does the committee's recommendation travel with this so that the next committee will see the recommendation?
So, Bobby, I think?
Whose responsibility is it to assure that those data to allow disparities to be measured the next time around are collected? Is it the person or the entity that's proposing the measure? So that if, in fact, those data aren't available the next time around, then the measure doesn't get approved?
It's not available, they just have to say why it's not available. I mean, it's not available, they can't collect it.
On the other hand, the CDC is perfectly capable of commissioning these studies, so the CDC can assure that it is available.
You have better faith in our budget than I do, but I did want to say one thing that we would be able to provide to the committee, although not immediately, is that we actually do have addresses for our participant facilities. So we could find the zip codes for you and construct an index of geographic disparity of that way, if that would be useful. We also collected data, for example, on urban, rural, or suburban status.
So we're actually doing two things at once here. Rita is using this to actually walk us through the process, and we're learning a lot about the process, and we have serious issues raised by this. Do we want to actually go through the process? We learn about the process and then make note of these, and then once we're in the process, come back and say, okay, what are we going to do about this?
Well, I think from my point of view, this is such an important issue. I couldn't go to sleep that I think it passed. So I think it may be imperfect, but it's the best we have, and let's start there with a strong recommendation that's improved for next time around.
And these disparities issues come up for every measure that we're dealing with right now. So this is not unique. This is an issue where we've got actually a disparities committee working on exactly how we should, what should we require as part of NQF submission. But we hear you. This is an important one for this measure as well.
Well, is there a way to address that systemically then? I mean, really, because you want to collect these data on everything rather than doing it one measure at a time. So how is that accomplished?
So then the way that this works is, at this point, the measure, if the measure is adopted, then it goes up as sort of a formal, so on the list of approved measures from NQF. And things would continue along. Those who use NQF measures as part of their, you gotta do this in order to get that, accrediting bodies or HEDIS or something else. The way that organizations would be forced to collect the data that would allow disparity to be measured is someone like HEDIS would have to adopt the measure, and then those entities that needed to demonstrate that they met HEDIS measures would then have to, because HEDIS adopted the NQF measure, would have to collect the data that would allow them to report on disparities. That's the cascade of events that NQF endorsement leads to.
NQF endorsement provides a group of measures that any number of implementers could potentially grab hold of. We certainly see a lot of it used by the federal government in a variety of programs. Often it's driven by the setting of care. And we can't totally foresee where and how, but I think some of the comments on this particular measure shows that the interest in likely being used perhaps among some of the federal programs or with the Joint Commission are sort of in the works, if you will.
We would use it at the state level because we would go in and respond to a dozen deaths in a nursing home in several times a year, and in those nursing homes we found out they had vaccination rates of their staff of about 30%. So if I had a standard like this, I would have gone right to the papers and published for every nursing home in our state what their rates of staff vaccinations were.
So we have Jackie Vaughn and Mike. I'm sorry, Madeline. Sorry.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that there, I see two components here. One is a workforce issue. The other is a population issue. And I think the recommendation should be that if you're going to be measuring immunization for the workforce, that should be stratified. Your population should be stratified there. And then the population served should be stratified as well. I think that's really a recommendation about the science. And I think it's a good recommendation for us to make, even though it's setting the bar a little high. But I think both of those are important. I mean, I would argue for the workforce, we really want to know if the nurses' age, as well as the registered nurses and the physicians, are being vaccinated. And that there's not discrimination by position in employment. So I think it's the kind of recommendation that we can make. And as I said, I also think it raises the bar. And it really means that the science has to be better. And I think we certainly can't require it. It'd be a recommendation.
So I don't think there's anything about this measure that can't be used to look at disparities. It's just that they haven't provided any data on that. So, you know, we're not saying that. So we're just seeing if say is this an appropriate measure, and the fact that they haven't provided data on disparities strikes me as not taking away from the quality of this measure.
Well, you get into a terrific can of worms when you try to stratify the workforce by title. It's very hard to do.
It's actually part of the measure. They've already put forward the measure is required to be stratified by employees, licensed independent practitioners, and then any students or trainees. So they've already done that piece. That's already part of this measure.
Well, that's just categorized. This isn't titled.
And that's arguably more important than stratifying it by race or anything like that, because that's really actionable. You can say, we have to take an intervention with the doctors and the nurses, the licensed practitioners, rather than with the employees.
The way they've categorized it, it's not really by title. So they've given categories that the facility has to stipulate. The other category they could do it by is by the EEO category. So that's professional, administrative, you know, like that technician.
So
I don't know if that would give you the value, but it seems like the way they want to do it is the most pertinent for this measure. People who are licensed, people who are actually employed. You've seen that data on how hard it is to do it by title.
So we have the distinction between the reporting on the population with the employees. Ron's been waiting for a long time, and then Levi, I'd like you to help us tell how we action these concerns for the measures.
So not fully understanding the process, I'm going to ask the question anyway. I'm a little bit troubled about the way the data are collected. Let's get beyond the disparities piece, that some of the data are self-report, some of the data are based on the facility record of whether or not they administered the shot. So the measure is used by a facility, and the change in the rate could be nothing more than a factor related to a change in the way the facility collects the data. And if a facility says your continued employment here is contingent upon you being vaccinated, and the facility is asking for self-report, the rate's going to go up. And so I don't know how that's considered again.
Yeah, if you could hold that thought until we move to the section on scientific acceptability where it's all about the data and reliability, hold on, it's an excellent point to be made. Right now we're still trying to finish the importance, okay? Who else wants to talk about importance?
Rhonda, your car's been going up and down.
Okay. First time through is always a start. So if we take a look at the ratings that were provided by the work group, does everybody feel this generally reflects how the entire group, do they only have any major issues with the way they are? Performance gap, there is one that's high. On the evidence, the quantity is high, the quality is moderate to high, and the consistency is high. Okay. Then as we move to the evaluation of how we take that information, plug it into the sort of the evaluation algorithm. Moderate to high in quantity, moderate to high in quality, moderate to high means that it would pass the evidence criteria. Does anybody have any objections to that? Okay. We don't need to worry about exceptions. So I guess at this point, you know, we could do a formal voting with our little gizmos, or is there anybody in the room who doesn't think this measurement meets the importance criteria? Okay. We're all critical.
Yeah, no, but it did occur to me that if these people don't take a lot of time, it does respect people's privacy.
Right.
And then I don't want to go after anybody. So.
Right. Well, that's why I was doing it in the name.
Who to go after.
Okay. So the next section is on scientific acceptability of the major properties. And this is where we're looking at the specifications themselves. We are looking at the reliability and the validity, and we are expecting those to have been tested and data provided. Again, disparities may come in this. When we're having, you know, internal discussions about what criteria disparities comes under, it seems to come under a lot of them. Just some guidance points. We are looking for empirical testing. We don't prescribe what type of testing. We really want it to be tested on the measure as specified. I think that CDC has outlined the testing that they did and the results that they had. So this is a good version of it. So this was the evaluation by the steering by the sub the work group in terms of the scientific acceptability. Linda, did you want to just summarize?
Sure. So the CDC did report their study data on reliability and validity, usability and feasibility, and it looks like we rated it moderate to high reliability, moderate validity. I think getting to some of Ron's issues about where the how valid the data are, but I don't know how you get around self-report. I mean, there's not a gold standard because people do get vaccines, you know, from the drugstore to the grocery store to lots of different places, and I don't, there's just no way to round that, but it does mean it's less valid, I think. Usability was rated high to moderate, and feasibility moderate, and I believe the feasibility rating, I don't remember here, had to do with just the challenges to developing, I mean, to figuring out which category employees fit into or people in the facilities, when they, you know, fit into which of those categories, and then collecting the information. I think that's what my thinking was in terms of feasibility, that it's not necessarily data that are routinely collected for other reasons. They have to be collected specifically for this sort of challenge of feasibility just a little bit. But there we are. That's as good as we're going to get, I think. So.
Is there any comments or discussion about the reliability validity? Ron, I think at this point that might be where your comments apply. Did you want to ask CDC if they have thoughts on that?
I'm debating. You know, I hear, Linda, what you're saying, and I'm thinking that, you know, for my employees, we have an employee handbook, and we require if an employee is out for a certain number of days, they need to bring in a something from a medical provider saying what's the issue. And if healthcare workers have a requirement, they could provide some documentation which would get beyond self-report. But I understand that. I mean, it could be costs related to that. There could be legal issues related to that, et cetera. So maybe, you know, CDC, how do you deal with this issue of the validity of what's being reported? You have you looked at the difference between self-report and documentation of vaccination?
We did. You bring up an excellent issue and one that we really ran into running with pilot, which is there's not a gold standard, and there are all these different kinds of documentation, and how do you do this? One general comment would be, that, of course, self-reported influenza vaccination has been studied among adults, and it's been found to be a highly sensitive and specific measure. Of course, those are in the general population, not necessarily in healthcare personnel that may have a job requirement. But there are not as significant problems with recall of influenza vaccination for self-report as there are with other vaccines. The other thing we did was to do a comparison between facilities. I took the three most commonly used data sources, and I'm sorry that I don't have the quantitative figures in front of me, but I can tell you that by far the most common data source reported was actually paper health records. So although the data are not available electronically, they are written down somewhere. The second most common source was electronic clinical data, and then what we did look at self-report status, although that was far less commonly used, which I find somewhat reassuring personally for the reasons that you bring up. So we had maybe, depending on the category, say 10, 12, 15% say, yes, we use self-report, but most of them did use documentation. And when we compared the median vaccination rates among those institutions reporting different types of data sources, we found that although the median did tend to move around a little, the rates were comparable in terms of being, within the same quartile. So you wouldn't get somebody who had a 60% vaccination rate suddenly changing their method of reporting and having an 80% or a 20% vaccination rate. And I know that a question that the table is in the Appendix E, which I know that you all probably didn't necessarily have to look at. And then there was a brief explanation of that testing in the Section 2D5. But we did look at that, and the results that we got suggested to our comfort that different sources of vaccination data would still produce acceptably comparable, although certainly not identical, results.
Right. I just want to make the point that this is an issue of, I think, all the influenza vaccine indicators we're looking at, and probably beyond that as well. And it's just an intrinsic problem.
Okay. We do have the voting gizmos. Everybody's got one in their hand. We're going to vote first on the reliability, and then next on the validity. You have the work group's initial ratings. So what we'll have you do when Kristen starts the clock is pick high, moderate, low, and push the proper button, 1, 2, or 3, or 4 for insufficient evidence. And this will be our trial. So
We have a process question. When we filled out the SurveyMonkey already, does that count as a vote, or we redo it here as an official vote?
You redo it here. Yeah. Right, because also consider that part of the voting is having you all together and raising issues, which could ultimately change your view one way or another, too. Chris, can you go on to the next slide? Okay, the next one is validity. And we're going through this one individually to see how this group wants to go as the exercise. We may be able to streamline this with the subsequent measures. But on validity, you do see the ratings from the work group, the discussion from CDC on the voting. So go ahead and vote on validity. Votes are too high, 11 moderate, too low, 4, 0, or insufficient is 0. Okay.
One person did good. One abstention.
Okay. In this particular case, we voted highly for reliability and moderate to high for validity, so it does pass the scientific acceptability criteria. So we're able to move on to usability criteria, which is the extent to which intended audiences, consumers, purchasers, policymakers, anyone out there can understand the results and find them useful. This is where we ask about usefulness for public reporting. So again, just to go back, you've seen this slide before, the usability rating of the work group was high 2, moderate 1. Comments that it's not currently reported, but there's a rule pending for CMS, and the Joint Commission does require it for hospitals. Linda, did you have any other comments on usability? Any other comments from the group? So we'll go ahead and vote on the usability. The results are 10 high, 5 moderate, and low is 0. Okay. So now we'll move on to the feasibility. And feasibility, I think, is some of the discussion you had, the extent to which the required data are readily available, retrievable without undue burden, and the measure can be implemented. I think these are some of the questions you have around data sources and collecting and having that data. So, any discussion around the feasibility?
Comment. Oh, one thing I noticed is 4B1, which is under electronic sources. It seemed like a common answer for that was some data elements are in electronic sources. And then the next question is, if all are not, then you need to answer this question. And I think that was never answered on any of the measures. And I'm not sure... Is that, as long as this question on the call too, is that insufficient? Does that mean it's moderate? It seems like nobody ever answered that question. I don't know if that's the processing or the reasons for that. Do we know?
Well, again, I think you balance the various subcomponents of each of these criteria, but we are certainly trying to drive development of the data systems to make this much more feasible. by using electronic data collection. And certainly some types of data will be more advanced in that than others. So it's not, again, it's a sub-criteria. It's not an all-or-none kind of thing, but you balance that sub-criteria in terms of the overall question of feasibility for the measure.
So I guess my next question is, do they not answer because they don't have an answer, or they just, do we know, do we have any idea?
Can CDC respond to that question?
The question is, there was a question about the proportion of data elements in electronic versus another column question that was not answered.
It's 4B1 and 4B2.
Correct.
So 4B2 only appears if you give a certain answer to 4B1. I think you said it was all or none, and since we said some, the question didn't appear. It got skipped out. That's why we didn't answer it.
So that's the format of the question.
Yeah, that's, and I didn't, that's a new one for me. Thank you, we learned something.
I couldn't figure out how we would have missed it otherwise.
Any further discussion on feasibility? So let's go ahead and vote on it. Yeah.
And with all categories in the numerator and the denominator, right? So collectively, how do we think? Do we think it's feasible or not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's high 0, moderate 12, low is 3. Okay. So, Christian, what's the next slide? So, this is the overall vote. This is the, do we feel that the measure has met all of the NQF criteria and is suitable for endorsement? Any discussion?
And where did we put the caveats? Separate.
Yes, 0 no's. So the group thinks this measure is suitable for endorsement. There were some caveats. There were some recommendations. Do we want to be sure that we have those captured appropriately? One was around stratification for disparities, that we'd like to see certainly by the time of their next endorsement cycle, that we want to see data for disparities as have been discussed. What are the other caveats? Is that it? Okay. For both the workforce and the population. All right. So I think CDC is hearing that message, but we'll certainly also follow up with them.
I'll put out that Paul's comments. Directly works to that question of how does the measure translate to the community, so thank you. That's a good segue.
Alright. The next measure on our list is 1659, influenza immunization. This is brought to us from CMS, and it is a measure for hospitalized patients. It is the inpatients aged 6 months and older discharged during October, November, December, January, February, and March who are screened for influenza vaccination status and vaccinated prior to discharge if indicated. Is someone from CMS on the phone to introduce the measure? Did you cook? Hello? This is inpatients.
Then I'm not the right
person. Okay, sorry. Okay. Sure, we can skip to the home health measure, which is 522. And this is the percentage of home health episodes of care during which patients received influenza immunization for the current flu season. So, Kizia, it's now your turn.
So, this measure received time-limited endorsement in 2009, and we conducted reliability and validity testing based on data collected during the first 9 months of 2010. The measure was initially specified based on the consensus recommendations. So while the publicly reported measure reports the number of home health episodes in which the patient received the vaccine for influenza either from the home health agency or from another provider which the home health agency confirmed, the additional measures of vaccine offered and refused or vaccine contraindicated are also calculated and then reported to the home health agencies themselves. I can briefly talk about the reliability and validity testing, or if you'd like me to talk a little more about the measure in general, I can do that.
I think, Jason, you were the reviewer for this one, correct? Why don't you... Okay. Why don't you start with the discussion, and certainly the developers are available if you have any questions for them.
Sure. Because this one is different than the previous measure, I thought it probably good to bring up what you had discussed earlier, Griffin, and that's this idea of a universal measure. If you look at all the 16 measures, and now we have 8, and a lot of the discussion we had at the work group was, why can't we have one measure that incorporates all of the denominators together? So we want to have a separate one for home health, separate one for inpatient, separate one for different age groups, high-risk populations, et cetera. We can maybe start with that discussion, what people feel about that, because that was one of the my comment on every single measure that I looked at on flu immunization was it should be incorporated into a universal measure.
Can we have some context for that? What are the possibilities for that happening, and how would that happen?
Can we ask the folks from CMS? Has there been a discussion between CDC and CMS about how that might be approached?
I'd like to just put some context around it because it's an issue that comes up. I mean, it's most dramatically obvious with these measures, but it comes up in other projects as well. And part of it is when you start looking at those detailed measure specifications, you'll see there are some differences because of the data source. So that needs to be specified. That's not an insurmountable issue in terms of having one measure. Probably the most practical issue is that currently we have measure developers that specify or specialize in a particular setting or data source, and it's just been impractical to coax measure developers to create measures that apply to other settings or data sources for which they don't have the knowledge or information about. So if you have some suggestions about those things, but those are kind of the two practical issues that we keep running up against.
I wonder if the idea that care is going to be hopefully increasingly integrated, that you can make an argument that you're looking out for the end user who has this cafe. I mean, is that a lever point? Bobby's next slide. I'll put it ahead of Bobby. But do you want to answer that?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there's, you know, the end user would love that. And NQF, you know, would certainly like to have that. It's just been a practical issue. And frankly, that's why we ended up with those standard specifications, so that even if we had to have different measures for different settings because of the unique data elements, that at least they would be aligned. I don't know if you're experiencing it here, that in the original project there were even more divisions of measures So, for example, sedation measures for COPD patients and then a separate measure for heart failure patients. And I think a lot of that has been resolved and combined, but the different settings and data sources is still a continued problem.
Jason, to understand what you were proposing, would it be to retain? Well, correct me if I'm right. Seems to me it's useful to know what's going on in the hospital, what's going on in the nursing home, what's going on in different settings, because there are different settings, and the process, perhaps, for making improvement in all those settings could be different. So when you raise the question about combining them all into a single measure, I'm not sure I understood what that would look like. And would you lose the granularity of the current measures if you did that?
Imagine a patient, though, who is in the hospital, would like to know their healthcare provider is vaccinated, who then gets assessed themselves and then goes out to a rehab facility and then goes to home healthcare. Wouldn't it be nice if there was one measure so that patient was measured the same way as they traveled through the system? Or even you could rely upon the facility transferring the patient to you for having measured that. That may not work in the system right now.
Is that a question of, well, so in what you just described, he still would want to know what the percentage was in each of those settings, right? And so is it a question of then, when you say having a common measure, is having a numerator and a denominator for each of those settings so that one could do that? It's not that the definition of the numerator and the definition of the denominator would be the same in each of those settings. So it strikes me that what you might possibly do is have the definition of the measure be the same in all those settings, but obviously has a different number for each one. But the problem is, though, that this home health one is based on episodes of care during the flu season, and the denominator would be different for other ones. Mm-hmm. So maybe the numerator can be more standardized, but the denominator doesn't seem possible.
Yeah, I mean, we can get to that later. That's another comment about how it doesn't actually fall under the standard specifications.
Right, so maybe, you know, this one could be defined in the same way that a hospitalization could be defined.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, I also think, I mean, maybe this is what you're getting at, but you can stratify it within the measure. So I don't think you have to lose that necessarily. But if you want a whole, we even have all these separate measures, how do you even compare who's getting vaccinated? If you have a whole measure, we know the percentage of people who are supposed to get vaccinated, here's how many are, just total. Well, I don't think you can do that at all now with to different measures. Or I think you can do that with a universal measure, but not lose maybe the individual type of measures. But I don't know. I mean, that's something. Could we do that?
Well, you can suggest that, but I don't know if you're going to get any takers of the measure developers. I mean, you don't have that measure in front of you, and I mean, I don't know. It's something that you'd have to see. I'm just saying from past experience, we haven't found anyone that was capable of doing that.
And we do know on the hospital side, for example, CMS has been doing work on the care tool, which would allow that transition across the various settings. And if they are interested, for example, in at least trying to get the same data elements across the different measures. And ultimately, if a care tool is available across that full set, that full continuum, that should get them closer, and I know they are working on that.
I think one of the measures, which we'll talk about, I guess, is trying to get close to that, which we'll talk about a little bit later. They're trying to incorporate, I think, isn't 41 trying to incorporate every outpatient into one? So I mean, that's probably as close as we have right now.
Matt, you saw something new or relevant?
I hope so. So there was a slide on this question right at the beginning of the packet about harmonization, and it seems to me that the issue is, can you harmonize the numerator? And then the denominators will be different depending on the population, but if the numerator is the same, then you've achieved that harmony, and maybe that's the thing that we can look at.
And recall that the prior attempt is to harmonize against that set of standard specifications as a way of making it clear what a numerator should look like.
So is the NQF mechanism then to approve these but give the measure developers 2 years to do that harmonization and come back and then you decide what to do about it, or is that what would happen?
I think there's a difference between harmonization and saying go back and try to at least align some of the key elements of the measures and asking them to come back with a combined measure. That's not something we can do in the course of a project. If there are specific questions about dates or immunizations or something like that, where they could go back, potentially make a change and bring it back to you to harmonize, that's different. I think then really you can only evaluate the measures before you and then make recommendations for additional measure development.
So to that point, the standard specifications for immunization are like the ones we saw before about the numerator. That it includes contraindications and decline. And there's no contraindications or decline in here, to, as far as I see. So it's inconsistent with the standard.
Actually, I would argue that the more inconsistency is the denominator, because the denominator is always for the standard specifications, this number of persons. And this is not measuring number of persons, this is not remembering the episodes like you mentioned before, Mike.
Oh, that's a maybe inappropriately that if someone was at two episodes during the flu season of home health care, they would only be counted once, and then maybe not. Yeah. Because they do ask about if you had a vaccine in the previous episode, then
that was my big issue with this, and hopefully maybe the person from CMS, they can address that, because it didn't seem to follow the influenza immunization standard measure specifications because of the denominator.
So this is Kavaya Kogan. I come to measure developer Acumen, and all of the home health quality measures are based off an episode of care, which is the period of time between the patient's start or resumption of home health care and their discharge or transfer from home health care. So because home health care is a service that's provided over multiple weeks, this is the most sensible way to quantify, you know, what an episode is. Would correspond to a hospitalization or something of that sort in a different setting.
But if someone had two episodes, say one in October and one in February of the next year, would they be counted in the database twice?
Yes, in this case they would. And the idea here is that the home health agency goes through a process, you know, each time they admit a patient to home health care, of assessing, you know, what are this patient's needs and what type of care do we need to provide to that patient. So they do that once in October, the first time they begin treating this patient. When that patient comes back in, you know, February, they do that process again. Of course, our items, you know, one of the responses the agency can give is we did not provide the vaccine to the patient this time because we vaccinated them, you know, earlier this year or this flu season. But it would be appropriate for the agency to document during both episodes that they confirmed the patient had an up-to-date vaccine status.
Okay, I think this is an example of one of the issues about the unique different data systems that are operating in nursing homes, home health agencies, hospitals, and is one of the current realities that we have to deal with. And, you know, so we can try to get things aligned as much as possible, but then we have to see about what's possible.
Bobby, and then Ed, are you up again, and then Paul?
Question. You called, there was a name for someone who actually developed the, algorithm for producing the measure or producing the data, that nobody would own that process sometimes until you're not able to get the data developed. What was that person called?
Well, we have the measure developer who
conceptualized and specified and then tested the measure.
Okay, so there's a question about whether anybody's actually collecting that. Once the measure's defined,
mm-hmm.
as a numerator and a denominator, someone has to collect that, which requires somebody to decide to do that or to require that that be done, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they could be implemented by any number of potential end users. In this particular case, with home health, because it's based on the CMS, OASIS data system, CMS implements these measures.
Okay. So what we have is, because we have a fragmented system and there's so many ways for people to fall through the cracks, we have a number of different measures that are for these different opportunities we have. That's the situation we're in.
Okay, so in the National Quality Strategy, which is an HHS document, one of the six priorities is to provide effective communication and coordination of care. And one of the goals of that is to improve the quality of care transitions and communications across care settings. So we just heard from two different parts of HHS who put this forward as a priority. That we didn't hear from them, but we've heard that, well, they can't work together. I don't accept that. I think we go back with another recommendation to them that the divisions in HHS, CDC for influenza vaccine among healthcare personnel, and CMS for hospitals and home health, sit down and harmonize these measures across care settings for the next time they come back. It's the same umbrella agency coming to us. We should be able to say to them, we recommend you sit down and harmonize.
I think the healthcare worker measure, isn't that for any setting?
Yeah.
Okay.
But still, why, I mean, wouldn't, ideally, the hospital
add up to the healthcare worker? Or are these patients just saying?
There was only the one CDC measure that covers all settings, I believe.
That's really too bad.
And then these are patient level, or, you know, they're for the different facilities, but it's about what the patient's being immunized.
Too bad. We need them for healthcare workers in those settings. But okay.
Is this the measure that where it does list all the other measures that are similar to it? There's a place for them to do that, right? I know one of the measures did list about three or four of them that were similar to it, and that would be your Paul's point.
It would be the first slide I showed you, essentially would be the same thing, this eight measures, except for maybe the first one, which is the healthcare personnel, but the other seven are essentially the same process of care.
Right.
Okay.
Is this the time to ask about contradictory evidence?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the Lancet article and the Cochrane review are pretty compelling, but the impact is not demonstrated, seen as ineffective. And I'm just wondering, the measure developers, how that was addressed?
Is Lou Madigan on the line?
I'm not sure what your question is in terms of how it was addressed. The list was initially submitted there. I don't know if that information was included in the initial submission because it was receiving a time-limited endorsement. And because the evidence has moved forward, I wanted to make sure that we included the most up-to-date information on the effectiveness of this.
You did specifically reference Lancet in the submission.
Right, and my question really gets to if the new evidence suggests that this is not effective.
It's very contradictory evidence. So, all the articles are different, of course, in terms of what they include. It's the same issue we have with any system manager review. Any of those kind of issues about what gets included in the study. So, in some cases, the study inclusions are different. I mean, it's a high body of evidence to evaluate because you can't do RCTs, of course.
Right. I mean, typically, the Cochrane reviews are pretty rigorous.
Right, exactly. I think the Lancet, my estimation, the Lancet review was as well. So I think that if your question is, are those really showing that these are ineffective, in some respect, I think that is in case, indeed, what it's saying. At the same time, I think this is why the CDC has encouraged immunization vaccine among older people and
the manufacturers are now providing the high dose influenza vaccine for older people for this exact reason. Does that answer your question?
So, well, let me see if I understand. The way I was reading this is that the ineffective was that having the individual vaccinated was not reducing hospitalization, was not reducing illness. It sounds like what you're saying is the strategy for getting them immunized has been ineffective. I'm trying to understand.
Oh, yeah. No, the effective, what we're trying to do is bring this process to healthcare. And so the outcomes that we were interested in were hospitalization. I was trying to find the evidence that in fact influenza vaccine was not severely reduced hospitalization.
Okay, so the individual is vaccinated and it does not necessarily reduce hospitalization. Okay, thank you.
It does reduce hospitalization for influenza and pneumonia.
Right, it doesn't reduce his hospitalization rates and death from respiratory disease.
Correct.
Thank you.
So any more comments on the importance criteria, which are the performance gap and the evidence?
Is this the place to talk about why the population definition doesn't agree? Because they're saying all home health visits, but the evidence is only for elderly. So every home health visit is not an elderly visit.
So the measure specifies to include those home health patients who meet the change in condition criteria. So it would be patients who are over 50 years old or patients who have one of a number of chronic conditions that, you know, the CDC recommends they receive annual flu vaccines. So those are the patients who are included in the home health measure. Anyone who meets age or condition guidelines.
In addition, this is where a large proportion of home healthcare patients are 65 and older. And depending on which surgery, it's somewhere between 75 and 80%.
Yeah, that is true, but you didn't state it. So you didn't state it in 2A1.1, brief measure information. So that's why I'm asking the question.
I think if you read through the numerator specification and the numerator exclusion, I think it's the numerator exclusion where it's most explicit that all home health episodes during the time period are included except for those that fail to meet the age or condition guidelines.
I'm just reading from the denominator exclusions that say episodes in which the patient does not meet the CDC guidelines for influenza vaccination. And the CDC guidelines for influenza vaccination have changed and do apply to everyone over the age of 6 months.
Okay. So then you need evidence for why it's efficacious for more than just the elderly. Do we have that? Is that evidence there?
Well, so I think we can just specify that evidence exists. I mean, right, so... I'm just looking at the number of measures we need to get through.
Yeah.
I think I'm really impressed with the ability of this group to switch gears just like that and go from the big picture of a new thing population to really incredibly detailed comments. I'm really impressed with the group, and I think we're learning about the process. I think we can go through this maybe one more, depending on how the time goes, and then we'll kind of reframe and think about how we're going to develop the process for getting to the others tomorrow. So, River, walk us through this, please.
So we've looked and talked about the importance to measure report. Go back one, Kristen. So I think that the question is, voting on importance to measure and report, If we look at the evidence criteria, it was rated sort of, there was a bit of a split there, one low, two high. The quality split again between high, moderate, and low, and the consistency was moderate and low. So, Jason, did you want to have any further comments about the quality, quantity, and consistency of the evidence?
I don't think any more than what you just said. I mean, I think there was a difference. I think from my perspective, I think it was based on the reading of the evidence, where, and I actually think there was additional evidence that they didn't submit, kind of what Kurt kind of mentioned, that we agree that there is more evidence. So I kind of the evidence they submitted, I think there's a certain level, but maybe if you know that there's actually additional evidence, you may have scored it a differently. But just based on what they submitted, I can understand, you know, the score, especially the low and moderate.
All right, given that, we really are going to have to get a sense of the committee in terms of how you're feeling about the evidence. I guess we can vote on those individually. Kristen, can you back it all the way up? Yeah, okay. Back up even, oh, okay. So one more pass, one more. Come forward. Here. Right. Did you want to vote on the performance gap? As 1B? Why don't we go ahead and do that, just so everybody can get on the program here. So we'll vote on the performance gap. It's 8 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, so generally the highs have it. Let's go on to the next one. This is the evidence decision, and I think we were a little uncertain on how people feel about quantity, quality, and consistency. So, Kristen, go on to the next one where we have the consistency of the evidence as presented, or as you know. How would you rate that? Three high, four moderate, six low, one insufficient. So it's 7 in the high, moderate, 6 in the low. Okay. So that's going to be more moderate there. Can we have one more?
Can I just be clear? I know what we're voting on. So it's consistency of the evidence that influenza immunization works in home health populations.
In populations, that basically in populations. I mean,
right.
Whether they're in home health or not,
it's
people greater than 6 months of age.
So I'm puzzled by the voting.
Well, that's right. So are we. Because it'll affect every measure that you look at.
Right. So we're just voting on
it. It makes this more confusing because the denominator is not a person. It's the episodes. That's what I think adds to your confusion. And to the confusion of people voting. Because it is, the denominator is everyone above 6 months.
Yeah.
It should be, I think. But
this is a good discussion for now, but as we go through the immunization measures, if we're going to stipulate that that everybody 6 months and older benefits from it, that's the same for all these. So we don't need to vote on this for each measure. Okay. You can re-vote this one.
Can I just point of information or question? We're not looking at the evidence specific to this measure, which is related to home health. Because the evidence related to home health is a lot different than the evidence related to, does influenza vaccine work? Is it effective? So I thought we were looking at the evidence related to this specific issue of home health. That's not the case?
Well, can you clarify what the difference is?
Well, actually, it's a good point, because you could make an argument that if a person's really isolated at home, the only people seeing them are home health workers who are vaccinated, they're at low risk, so you could make an argument.
They're still exposed to children and other vectors.
The difference is what's presented in this information before us, and I know, you know, Jason mentioned that it was related to hospital admissions for respiratory ailments. The way I read what is presented is it says the Lancet article and the Cochrane review both say that it's ineffective. Ineffectiveness of influenza immunization for influenza-like illness and pneumonia among community-dwelling older people. It doesn't say that it, I mean, to me that includes influenza. So the research that's presented, the more current research from Lancet and from Cochrane, suggests that it's not effective.
I think you need to read that whole sentence. It's ineffective in the prevention of influenza, influenza-like illness, and pneumonia. It does not reduce hospitalization rates and death for respiratory, but does reduce hospitalization for influenza and pneumonia and reduce all-cause mortality.
I'm looking at it. I'm on page 4 of the... Page 5?
Yeah, I'm on 1C14.
Right.
1C14.
On page 5. And the Cochrane says the same thing. Well-matched vaccines were associated with reduced hospitalization from influenza, pneumonia, and all-cause mortality.
Okay.
So you're right. It doesn't prevent this, but it does work on this.
I think there was a desire to revote these now that we've had this additional discussion.
Sure.
Okay. All righty. Any other comments before we do that? So we'll go back to the first question on evidence, and that's the consistency. So how do you vote on consistency? What's the matter, Kristen? Okay. All right, the results are high. Or moderate, 8, so that gives us the high moderate rating that is needed. The next one, Kristen, is the quantity of studies. That's the one we didn't vote before. It's 6 high and 6 moderate. So definitely it's high moderate here. And 1C is the quality of the body of evidence. You can vote on that. One high, 11 moderate, 0 low. So the moderates win on that. So if we go to the decision, go back one. The quantity was moderate to high, the quality was moderate, and the consistency was high moderate, so it does pass. Okay. All right, next one. So overall, we've seen the evidence for performance gap, and we've seen the evidence. So does this measure, we don't need this one. Yeah. All of these criteria must be met. Go to the next one. Oh. Wait a minute, didn't we have one that's yes and no?
No.
If it met those criteria, you don't, I mean, it's just in the past. Yeah. Okay. So we do have. So we'll move on to scientific acceptability of the measure of properties. And here are the initial ratings by the work group. Jason, did you want to comment on scientific acceptability before we vote on reliability and validity?
probably only to say that it's kind of similar to, it seemed like it was similar to the discussion we had on the evidence itself, that there was kind of a range, I think, depending on how people looked at it. And there are specific comments to do with the rationale, and there are specific points that people made. And again, the discussion about the timing of the episodes. I think this comes back to this issue. For me, it comes back to this issue of the denominator not being a person or a population to these episodes. So,
did you have a chance to look at the testing results for the reliability and validity that they provided?
Did I? Mm-hmm. Yes, I did.
And what's your assessment?
I thought overall they were actually okay. I'm trying to remember what I voted. I think I voted moderate. They seemed to, from what I can recall, they seemed pretty good, pretty detailed. I can't remember anything specific. One issue I did have is the proxies that they used. They used acute care, hospitalization, and improvement in dyspnea as proxies for somebody receiving the immunization, and that there would be improvements in those two outcomes for those who did receive immunization. I'm not sure those were the best proxies to use. I think that's why I probably gave it a little bit lower rating.
Okay. Any other comments on reliability?
I'm having a hard time seeing it. So our episodes of home health routinely reported, I mean, that's a reportable, I guess because for billing purposes, so that's a routine measure that's regularly reported, an episode
right.
of home health.
I think you would think of it as being analogous to a hospital stay. It's just in home health, patients are seen for a longer period of time, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and things are measured over that episode of care. So it is about patients, but it's their unit of measurement because that's how long patients stay in home health care. And CMS may want to add something to that, but I think that's the reason that they're using episodes.
Are you ready to vote for reliability? Okay. For reliability, 3 high, 10 moderate. So that's the moderate for reliability. The next one is validity. Any discussion on validity? Comments, Jason or Linda? Anybody have any?
Sorry, I think my previous comment was related to validity, not reliability.
Okay.
Sorry about the improvement in dyspnea and the acute care hospitalization.
Alright. Any other discussion before voting? Okay, let's go ahead and vote. Zero for high, 13 moderate, 1 is low. Okay, so moderate there. And both reliability and validity must be rated moderate or high to pass the criteria, and they were both rated moderate, so it does pass. We want to look at usability. Comments, Jason, on usability of this measure?
The one comment, and this was a question, I guess, for the developer, was there was no answers for usefulness for quality improvement. And I wasn't sure if that didn't come up or if there was a reason they skipped that.
So I think we had an issue that NCIP updated these forms after we completed them. So I think there were just some items that didn't appear on the initial forms we filled out.
Okay, thanks. I don't have any other comments.
So what about this issue, maybe not good to discuss now, but this idea of the relevance of these measures to immunization registries, if we're talking about relevance for population reporting, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a longer discussion than maybe we have the time for. But is there any relationship between this kind of reporting and what actually gets reported to immunization registries? Just no relationship?
Very few immunization registries are recording adult immunizations now. A couple of states are just beginning it, but I doubt they get at the level of home health care.
So, what's the answer then? I mean, I don't know if it's in a general concept that there should be some relationship or not. You'll see that same comment on all of the immunization ones, partly it's from me. Because it just seems to me that they're for public reporting, this is really how you assess population health, not in the individual home health care agency, it's in the population. So, I think we might
I CDC does have a busted survey item on flu vaccination for all everybody. That population health one that we know of.
The question I have about that
has to do with kind of again the question of how the not so much the value of the data, but how the data informs action. And I mean the value for me is something like home health versus overall population is that it gets a group of people to feel like there's something specific they can do to move their numbers. And I'm not sure I fully understand it, but that's what feels really important to me, is that there are all these subgroups that we need to move their numbers on immunization, and in a way just looking at the big picture doesn't as well move the subgroups.
Jackie, for you, would a population measure look different from an aggregation of the individual measures?
That is one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and that's why I'm saying maybe now is not the time to do it, but there doesn't seem to be a link between what's going on here with this quality reporting and then quality of the public health system in general, and I don't have the answer to how to create that, but, you know, you've got two different people looking at it from a different point of view. It seems like there should be some efficiencies there.
Well, optimally, there would be a vaccine registry to use, but it's going to be a long time before we get there practically. But I don't think we could look at adding up these separate measures as an indication of the population, because hopefully most people are not in health care. They're healthy.
An example of why the work that the three subgroups did today and eventually, once they're adopted, would be useful to act to provide a structure for answering that question. Because what we would do is we'd say, okay, well, we have this clinical measure, which is what this is, basically, and then we'd ask ourselves, walk ourselves back in the model and say, well, is there some population, is there some way to think about this on a population basis? And if there is, where is it appropriate to be thinking about that on a population basis? And what does it mean, then, to be thinking about it at those different steps? Right? Isn't that how we have a structured way to think about clinical measures as well as whatever we ultimately came up with on population?
You have an immunization registry that reports something, and then you have these other measures, and they have some relationship to each other. It tells you something.
Yeah, from my perspective, it's more than just simply adding them up, because one of the things that was mentioned at the beginning of the discussion was that the population measures are not simply adding up individual measures. They're conceptually different from simply adding things up.
So that's it, the idea of the situation, so you understand. Well, yes, you have an immunization rate of 80%, but among these high-risk populations, we know that these people are more at risk. That's the kind of information that you need. That's what immunization registries give now, is just a global figure. But now we have all these different measures occurring in these people who are moving the numbers, as you say. So what's the situational awareness for the health officer or for the health authority, for that jurisdiction or the country?
And you're right, it's a bit late in the day to dive in. But maybe we can put that on the agenda to talk about briefly tomorrow is, how does this fit into the context of the previous conversation? Are we interested, for example, in influenza or influenza mortality for a population. And then you could use the model to say, okay, we've got a number of immunization rates for a bunch of different populations. What does that add up to? Not just in the cumulative immunization rate, but in the mortality and morbidity associated with the flu.
So we'll put that on the agenda for tomorrow.
So we could finish up this measure and see what you think about usability. If you're ready to vote, yeah? Let's vote. Response is 4 high, 7 moderate, 1 low. So that's a moderate to high rating. All right. And the next one is feasibility. Any comments on feasibility before we vote? No? Ready to vote? Let's vote. High, 9 moderate. So again, a moderate score. So we voted on all four criteria. The overall vote, does this measure meet the criteria to be suitable for endorsement? Any further discussion? Ready to vote? Let's vote. Yes, 10, no, 1. 10, the yeses have it.
Just a no person won't say anything. Or protect their anonymity. So this is when we open it up for public comment? Because we're at the extra 525.
Hmm? Yeah. That's the end of our agenda for today. Yeah, we should take the public comment.
Is there anyone on the anyone on the telephone who'd like to make a comment from the public?
Anthony, is there anyone who wants to ask a question? Yeah. Anybody in the room?
Very good. Well, that does wrap up our agenda for the day. Thank you everyone for being here for a very long day of a lot of hard work. My mind is fried. I imagine some of yours might be also. You can get home, get some rest, and so we can retry it again tomorrow.
Yeah. This is Reva. I just want to talk to the folks on the phone. I know you've been waiting, and thank you so much for your patience. Again, the conversations went longer than expected. We will be starting again at 8 o'clock in the morning. Please let us know if you're not going to be able to join us tomorrow. Elisa and Kristen and I will be monitoring our email from any messages from you. And we'll see everybody tomorrow at 8. I'll take your voting choice with you.